Get up, you sleepyhead. Get out, get out, get out of bed. Live, love, laugh, and be happy. Both guitar and voice came to a sudden halt. Jack, who had been concentrating fiercely on the blind man's face, trying subconsciously to peer right through those dark glasses, perhaps, and see if Speedy Parker's eyes were behind them, now widened his focus and saw two cops standing beside the blind man. "You know, I don't hear nothing," the blind guitarist said, almost coyly. "But I believe I smell something blue." "God damn it, Snowball, you know you're not supposed to work the mall," one of the cops cried. "What did Judge Hallis tell you the last time he had you in chambers? Downtown, between Center Street and Mural Street. No place else. Damn, boy, how senile have you got? Your pecker rotted off yet from that what-all your woman gave you before she took off? Christ, I just don't..." His partner put a hand on his arm and nodded toward Jack in a little pitchers-have-big-ears gesture. "Go tell your mother she wants you, kid," the first cop said curtly. Jack started walking down the sidewalk. He couldn't stay. Even if there was something he could do, he couldn't stay. He was lucky the cop's attention had been taken up by the man they called Snowball. If they'd given him a second chance, Jack had no doubt he would have been asked to produce his bona fides. New sneakers or not, the rest of him looked used and battered. It doesn't take cops long to get good at spotting road kids, and Jack was a boy on the road if there ever had been one. He imagined being tossed into the Zanesville pokey while the Zanesville cops, fine upstanding boys in blue who listened to Paul Harvey every day and supported President Reagan, tried to find out whose little boy he was. No, he didn't want the Zanesville cops giving him more than the one passing glance. A motor throbbing smoothly coming up behind him. Jack hunched his pack a little higher on his back and looked down at his new sneakers as if they interested him tremendously. From the corners of his eyes, he saw the police cruiser slide slowly by. The blind man was in the back seat, the neck of his guitar poking up beside him. As the cruiser swung into one of the outbound lanes, the blind man abruptly turned his head and looked out the back window, looked directly at Jack. And although Jack could not see through the dirty, dark glasses, he knew perfectly well that Lester Speedy Parker had winked at him. Jack managed to keep further thought at bay until he reached the turnpike ramps again. He stood looking at the signs, which seemed the only clear-cut things left in a world, worlds, where all else was a maddening gray swirl. He felt a dark depression swirling all around him, sinking into him, trying to destroy his resolve. He recognized that homesickness played a part in this depression, but this feeling made his former homesickness seem boyish and callow indeed. He felt utterly adrift, without a single firm thing to hold on to. Standing by the signs, watching the traffic on the turnpike, Jack realized he felt damn near suicidal. For quite a while, he had been able to keep himself going with the thought that he would see Richard Sloat soon, and although he had hardly admitted the thought to himself, the idea that Richard might head west with him had done more than cross Jack's mind. After all, it would not be the first time that a Sawyer and a Sloat had made strange journeys together, would it? But the hard work at the Palo Mountain farm and the peculiar happenings at the Buckeye Mall had given even that the false glitter of fool's gold. "Go home, Jackie, you're beaten," a voice whispered. "If you keep on, you're going to end up getting the living shit kicked out of you, and next time it may be 50 people that die, or 500. I-70 East, I-70 West. Abruptly, he fished in his pocket for the coin that was a silver dollar in this world. Let whatever gods there were decide this once and for all. He was too beaten to do it himself, his back still smarted where Mr. All-America had whacked him. Come up tails, and he would go down the eastbound ramp and head home. Come up heads, he would go on, and there would be no more looking back. He stood in the dust of the soft shoulder and flicked the coin into the chilly October air. It rose, turning over and over, kicking up glints of sun. Jack craned his head to follow its course. A family, passing in an old station wagon, stopped squabbling long enough to look at him curiously. The man driving the wagon, a balding CPA, who sometimes awoke in the middle of the night fancying that he could feel shooting pains in his chest and down his left arm, had a sudden and absurd series of thoughts. Adventure, danger, a quest of some noble purpose, dreams of fear and glory. He shook his head as if to clear it, and glanced at the boy in the wagon's rearview mirror just as the kid leaned over to look at something. Christ, the balding CPA thought. Get it out of your head, Larry. You sound like a fucking boy's adventure book. Larry shot into traffic, quickly getting the wagon up to 70, forgetting about the kid in the dirty jeans by the side of the road. If he could get home by 3, he'd be in good time to watch the middleweight title fight on ESPN. The coin came down. Jack bent over it. It was heads. But that was not all. The lady on the coin wasn't Lady Liberty. It was Laura Deloessian, Queen of the Territories. But God, what a difference here from the pale, still, sleeping face he had glimpsed for a moment in the pavilion, surrounded by anxious nurses in their billowing white wimples. This face was alert and aware, eager and beautiful. It was not a classic beauty, the line of the jaw was not clear enough for that, and the cheekbone, which showed in profile, was a little soft. Her beauty was in the regal set of her head, combined with the clear sense that she was kind as well as capable. And oh, it was so like the face of his mother. Jack's eyes blurred with tears, and he blinked them hard, not wanting the tears to fall. He had cried enough for one day. He had his answer, and it was not for crying over. When he opened his eyes again, Laura Deloessian was gone. The woman on the coin was Lady Liberty again. He had his answer all the same. Jack bent over, picked up the coin out of the dust, put it in his pocket, and headed down the westbound ramp of Interstate 70. A day later, white overcast in the air that tasted of chilly rain on its way. The Ohio-Indiana border not much more than a lick and a promise from here. Here was in a scrub of woods beyond the Lewisburg rest area on I-70. Jack was standing, concealed, he hoped, among the trees, patiently waiting for the large, bald man with the large, bald voice to get back into his Chevy Nova and drive away. Jack hoped he would go soon before it started to rain. He was cold enough without getting wet, and all morning his sinuses had been plugged, his voice foggy. He thought he must finally be getting a cold. The large bald man with the large bald voice had given his name as Emery W. Light. He had picked Jack up around 11 o'clock north of Dayton, and Jack had felt a tired, sinking sensation in the pit of his belly almost at once. He had gotten rides with Emery W. Light before. In Vermont, Light had called himself Tom Ferguson and said he was a shoe shop foreman. In Pennsylvania, the alias had been Bob Darrant, almost like that fellow who sang Splish Splash, ah-ha-ha-ha, and the job had changed to district high school superintendent. This time, Light said he was president of the First Mercantile Bank of Paradise Falls in the town of Paradise Falls, Ohio. Ferguson had been lean and dark, Darrant was portly and pink as a freshly tubbed baby, and this Emery W. Light was large and owlish, with eyes like boiled eggs behind his rimless glasses. Yet all of these differences were only superficial, Jack had found. They all listened to the story with the same breathless interest. They all asked him if he had had any girlfriends back home. Sooner or later he would find a hand, a large bald hand, lying on his thigh, and when he looked at Ferguson slash Darrant slash Light, he would see an expression of half-mad hope in the eyes mixed with half-mad guilt, and a stipple of sweat on the upper lip. In the case of Darrant, the sweat had gleamed through a dark mustache like tiny white eyes peering through scant underbrush. Ferguson had asked him if he would like to make $10. Darrant had upped that to 20. Light, in a large, bald voice that nonetheless cracked and quivered through several registers, asked him if he couldn't use $50. He always kept a 50 in the heel of his left shoe, he said, and he'd just love to give it to Master Louis Farron. There was a place they could go near Randolph, an empty barn. Jack did not make any correlation between the steadily increasing monetary offers from Light in his various incarnations and any changes his adventures might be working on him. He was not introspective by nature and had little interest in self-analysis. He had learned quickly enough how to deal with fellows like Emery W. Light. His first experience with Light, when Light had been calling himself Tom Ferguson, had taught him that discretion was by far the better part of valor. When Ferguson put his hand on Jack's thigh, Jack had responded automatically out of a California sensibility in which gaze had been merely part of the scenery. "No, thanks, mister. I'm strictly AC." He had been groped before, certainly, in movie theaters mostly, but there had been the men's shop clerk in North Hollywood who had cheerfully offered to blow him in a changing booth, and when Jack told him no thanks, the clerk said, "Fine, now try on the blue blazer, okay?" These were annoyances a good-looking 12-year-old boy in Los Angeles simply learned to put up with, the way a pretty woman learns to put up with being groped occasionally on the subway. You eventually find a way to cope without letting it spoil your whole day. The deliberate passes, such as the one this Ferguson was making, were less of a problem than the sudden gropes from ambush. They could simply be shunted aside. At least in California they could. Eastern gays, especially out here in the sticks, apparently had a different way of dealing with rejection. Ferguson had come to a screeching, sliding halt, leaving 40 yards of rubber behind his Pontiac and throwing a cloud of shoulder dust into the air. "Who are you calling DC?" he screamed. "Who are you calling queer? I'm not queer! Jesus, give a kid a fucking ride and he calls you a fucking queer!" Jack was looking at him, dazed. Unprepared for the sudden stop, he had thumped his head a damn good one on the padded dash. Ferguson, who had only a moment before been looking at him with melting brown eyes, now looked ready to kill him. "Get out!" Ferguson yelled. "You're the queer, not me! You're the queer! Get out, you little queer boy! Get out! I've got a wife, I've got kids, I've probably got bastards scattered all over New England! I'm not queer! You're the queer, not me, so get out of my car!" More terrified than he had been since his encounter with Osman, Jack had done just that. Ferguson tore out, spraying him with gravel, still raving. Jack staggered over to a rock wall, sat down, and began to giggle. The giggles became shrieks of laughter, and he decided right then and there that he would have to develop a policy, at least until he got out of the boondocks. "Any serious problem demands a policy," his father had said once. Morgan had agreed vigorously, but Jack decided he shouldn't let that hold him back. His policy had worked well enough with Bob Darrant, and he had no reason to believe it wouldn't also work with Emery Light. But in the meantime, he was cold and his nose was running. He wished Light would head him up and move him out. Standing in the trees, Jack could see him down there, walking back and forth with his hands in his pockets, his large, bald head gleaming mellowly under the white-out sky. On the turnpike, big semis droned by, filling the air with the stink of burned diesel fuel. The woods here were trashed out the way the woods bordering any interstate rest area always were. Empty Dorito bags, squashed Big Mac boxes, crimped Pepsi and Budweiser cans with pop-tops that rattled inside if you kicked them, smashed bottles of Wild Irish Rose and 5 o'clock gin. A pair of shredded nylon panties over there, with a moldering sanitary napkin still glued to the crotch. A rubber poked over a broken branch. Plenty of nifty stuff, all right. Hey, hey. And lots of graffiti jotted on the walls of the men's room. Almost all of it the sort of fellow like Emery W. Light could really relate to. "I like to suck big fat cocks. Be here at 4 for the best blowjob you ever had. Ream out my butt." And here was a gay poet with large aspirations. "Let the whole human race jerk off on my smiling face." "I'm homesick for the territories," Jack thought. And there was no surprise at all in the realization. Here he stood behind 2 brick outhouses off I-70 somewhere in western Ohio, shivering in a ragged sweater he had bought in a thrift store for $1.50, waiting for that large bald man down there to get back on his horse and ride. Jack's policy was simplicity itself. Don't antagonize a man with large bald hands and a large bald voice. Jack sighed with relief. Now it was starting to work. An expression that was half anger, half disgust, had settled over Emery W. Light's large, bald face. He went back to his car, got in, backed up so fast he almost hit the pickup truck passing behind him. There was a brief blare of horns, and the passenger in the truck shot Emery W. Light the finger, and then left. Now it was only a matter of standing on the ramp where the rest area traffic rejoined the turnpike traffic with his thumb out, and he hoped catching a ride before it started to rain. Jack spared another look around. Ugly. Wretched. These words came quite naturally to mind as he looked around at the littery desolation here on the rest area's pimply backside. It occurred to Jack that there was a feeling of death here, not just at this rest area or on the interstate roads, but pressed deep into all the country he had traveled. Jack thought that sometimes he could even see it, a desperate shade of hot, dark brown, like the exhaust from the short stack of a fast-moving Jimmy Pete. The new homesickness came back, the wanting to go to the territories and see that dark blue sky, the slight curve at the edge of the horizon. But it plays those Jerry Bledsoe changes. Don't know nothing about that. All I know is you seem to have this idea of murder a little broad. Walking down to the rest area, now he really did have to urinate, Jack sneezed 3 times quickly. He swallowed and winced at the hot prickle in his throat. Getting sick, oh yeah, great. Not even into Indiana yet. 50 degrees, rain in the forecast, no ride, and now I'm... The thought broke off cleanly. He stared at the parking lot, his mouth falling wide open. For one awful moment, he thought he was going to wet his pants, as everything below his breastbone seemed to cramp and squeeze. Sitting in one of the 20 or so slant parking spaces, its deep green surface now dulled with road dirt, was Uncle Morgan's BMW. No chance of a mistake, no chance at all. California vanity plates MLS, standing for Morgan Luther Sloat. It looked as if it had been driven fast and hard. But if he flew to New Hampshire, how can his car be here? Jack's mind yammered. It's a coincidence, Jack. Just a... Then he saw the man standing with his back to him at the pay telephone and knew it was no coincidence. He was wearing a bulky army-style anorak, fur-lined, a garment more suited to 5 below than to 50 degrees. Back to or not, there was no mistaking those broad shoulders and that big, loose, hulking frame. The man at the phone started to turn around, crooking the phone between his ear and shoulder. Jack drew back against the brick side of the men's toilet. Did he see me? No, he answered himself. No, I don't think so. But Captain Farron had said that Morgan, that other Morgan, would smell him like a cat smells a rat. And so he had. From his hiding place in that dangerous forest, Jack had seen the hideous white face in the window of the diligence change. This Morgan would smell him, too, if given the time. Footfalls around the corner, approaching. Face numb and twisted with fear, Jack fumbled off his pack and then dropped it, knowing he was too late, too slow, that Morgan would come around the corner and seize him by the neck, smiling. Hi, Jackie. Ollie, ollie, in free. Game's over now, isn't it, you little prick? A tall man in a houndstooth check jacket passed the corner of the restroom, gave Jack a disinterested glance, and went to the drinking fountain. Going back. He was going back. There was no guilt, at least not now, only that terrible, trapped fear mingling oddly with feelings of relief and pleasure. Jack fumbled his pack open. Here was Speedy's bottle, with less than an inch of the purple liquid now left. No boy needs that poison to travel with, but I do, Speedy, I do, sloshing around in the bottom. No matter, he was going back. His heart leaped at the thought. A big Saturday night grin dawned on his face, denying both the gray day and the fear in his heart. Going back, oh yeah, dig it. More footsteps approaching, and this was Uncle Morgan. No doubt about that heavy yet somehow mincing step. But the fear was gone. Uncle Morgan had smelled something, but when he turned the corner he would see nothing but empty Dorito bags and crimped beer cans. Jack pulled in breath, pulled in the greasy stink of diesel fumes and car exhausts and cold autumn air, tipped the bottle up to his lips, took one of the 2 swallows left, and even with his eyes shut, he squinted as... Chapter 16. Wolf. The strong sunlight struck his closed lids. Through the gagging, sweet odor of the magic juice, he could smell something else. The warm smell of animals. He could hear them, too, moving all about him. Frightened, Jack opened his eyes, but at first could see nothing. The difference in the light was so sudden and abrupt that it was as if someone had suddenly turned on a cluster of 200-watt bulbs in a black room. A warm, hide-covered flank brushed him, not in a threatening way, or so Jack hoped, but most definitely in an I'm-in-a-hurry-to-be-gone-thank-you-very-much way. Jack, who had been getting up, thumped back to the ground again.
Hey, get away from him right here and right now!
A loud, healthy whack, followed by a disgruntled animal sound, somewhere between a moo and a baa.
God's nails, got no sense. Get away from him, before I bite your god-pounding eyes out!
Now his eyes had adjusted enough to the brightness of this almost flawless territory's autumn day to make out a young giant standing in the middle of a herd of milling animals, whacking their sides and slightly humped backs with what appeared to be great gusto and very little real force. Jack sat up, automatically finding Speedy's bottle with its one precious swallow left, and putting it away. He never took his eyes from the young man who stood with his back to him. Tall he was, 6'5" at least, Jack guessed, and with shoulders so broad that his across still looked slightly out of proportion to his high. Long, greasy black hair shagged down his back to his shoulder blades. Muscles bulged and rippled as he moved amid the animals, which looked like pygmy cows. He was driving them away from Jack and toward the western road. He was a striking figure, even when seen from behind. But what amazed Jack was his dress. Everyone he had seen in the territories, including himself, had been wearing tunics, jerkins, or rough breeches. This fellow appeared to be wearing Oshkosh bib overalls. Then he turned around, and Jack felt a horrible, shocked dismay well up in his throat. He shot to his feet. It was the Elroy thing. The herdsman was the Elroy thing. Except it wasn't. Jack perhaps would not have lingered to see that, and everything that happened thereafter, the movie theater, the shed, and the hell of the sunlight home, would not have happened, or would, at the very least, have happened in some completely different way. But in the extremity of his terror, he froze completely after getting up. He was no more able to run than a deer is when it is frozen in a hunter's jacklight. As the figure in the bib overalls approached, he thought, Elroy wasn't that tall or that broad, and his eyes were yellow. The eyes of this creature were a bright, impossible shade of orange. Looking into them was like looking into the eyes of a Halloween pumpkin. And while Elroy's grin had promised madness and murder, the smile on this fellow's face was large and cheerful and harmless. His feet were bare, huge and spatulate, the toes clumped into groups of three and two, barely visible through curls of wiry hair. Not hoof-like, as Elroy's had been, Jack realized, half-crazed with surprise, fear, a dawning amusement, but pad-like, paw-like. As he closed the distance between himself and Jack, his, its, eyes flared an even brighter orange, going for a moment to the day-glow shade favored by hunters and flagmen on road repair jobs. The color faded to a muddy hazel. As it did, Jack saw that his smile was puzzled as well as friendly, and understood two things at once. First, that there was no harm in this fellow, not an ounce of it. And second, that he was slow. Not feeble, perhaps, but slow.
Wolf!
The big, hairy boy beast cried, grinning. His tongue was long and pointed, and Jack thought with a shudder that a wolf was exactly what he looked like. Not a goat, but a wolf. He hoped he was right about there not being any harm in him. But if I made a mistake about that, at least I won't have to worry about making any more mistakes ever again.
Wolf! Wolf! He stuck out one hand, and Jack saw that, like his feet, his hands were covered with hair, although this hair was finer and more luxuriant, actually quite handsome. It grew especially thick in the palms, where it was the soft white of a blaze on a horse's forehead. "My God, I think he wants to shake hands with me." Gingerly, thinking of Uncle Tommy, who had told him he must never refuse a handshake, not even with his worst enemy, fight him to the death afterward if you must, but shake his hand first, Uncle Tommy had said, Jack put his own hand out, wondering if it was about to be crushed, or perhaps eaten. "Wolf! Wolf! Shaking hands right here and now!" the boy thing in the Oshkosh Bibbles cried, delighted. "Right here and now! Good old Wolf! God pound it! Right here and now! Wolf!" In spite of this enthusiasm, Wolf's grip was gentle enough, cushioned by the crisp, furry growth of hair on his hand. Bib overalls and a big handshake from a guy who looks like an overgrown Siberian husky and smells a little bit like a hayloft after a heavy rain, Jack thought. What next? An offer to come to his church this Sunday? "Good old Wolf, you bet! Good old Wolf right here and now!" Wolf wrapped his arms around his huge chest and laughed, delighted with himself. Then he grabbed Jack's hand again. This time his hand was pumped vigorously up and down. Something seemed required of him at this point, Jack reflected. Otherwise this pleasant, if rather simple, young man might go on shaking his hand until sundown. "Good old Wolf," he said. It seemed to be a phrase of which his new acquaintance was particularly fond. Wolf laughed like a child and dropped Jack's hand. This was something of a relief. The hand had been neither crushed nor eaten, but it did feel a bit seasick. Wolf had a faster pump than a slot machine player on a hot streak. "Stranger, ain't ya?" Wolf asked. He stuffed his hairy hands into the slit sides of his bibballs and began playing pocket pool with a complete lack of self-consciousness. "Yes," Jack said, thinking of what that word meant over here. It had a very specific meaning over here. "Yes, I guess that's just what I am, a stranger."
"God pounding right. I can smell it on you, right here and now. Oh, yeah, oh, boy, got it. Doesn't smell bad, you know, but it sure is funny. Wolf, that's me, Wolf, Wolf, Wolf."
He threw back his head and laughed. The sound ended being something that was disconcertingly like a howl. "Jack," Jack said. Jack saw his hand was seized again and pumped with abandon. "Sawyer," he finished when he was released again. He smiled, feeling very much as though someone had hit him with a great big goofy stick. 5 minutes ago, he had been standing scrunched against the cold brick side of a shithouse on I-70. Now he was standing here talking to a young fellow who seemed to be more animal than man. And damned if his cold wasn't completely gone.
"Wolf meet Jack. Jack meet Wolf. Here and now. Okay, good. Old Jason, cows in the road. Ain't they stupid? Wolf, Wolf."
Yelling, Wolf loped down the hill to the road, where about half of his herd was standing, looking around with expressions of bland surprise, as if to ask where the grass had gone. They really did look like some strange cross between cows and sheep, Jack saw, and wondered what you would call such a crossbreed. The only word to come immediately to mind was creeps, or perhaps he thought the singular would be more proper in this case, as in, here's Wolf taking care of his flock of creep. Oh yeah, right here and now. The goofy stick came down on Jack's head again. He sat down and began to giggle, his hands crisscrossed over his mouth to stifle the sounds. Even the biggest creeps stood no more than 4 feet high. Their fur was woolly, but of a muddy shade that was similar to Wolf's eyes, at least when Wolf's eyes weren't blazing like Halloween jack-o'-lanterns. Their heads were topped with short, squiggly horns that looked good for absolutely nothing. Wolf herded them back out of the road. They went obediently with no sign of fear. If a cow or a sheep on my side of the jump got a whiff of that guy, Jack thought, it'd kill itself trying to get out of his way. But Jack liked Wolf, liked him on sight, just as he had feared and disliked Elroy on sight. And that contrast was particularly apt, because the comparison between the two was undeniable. Except that Elroy had been goatish, while Wolf was, well, wolfish.
Jack walked slowly toward where Wolf had set his herd to graze. He remembered tiptoeing down the stinking back hall of the Oatley Tap toward the fire door, sensing Elroy somewhere near, smelling him, perhaps, as a cow on the other side would undoubtedly smell Wolf. He remembered the way Elroy's hands had begun to twist and thicken, the way his neck had swelled, the way his teeth had become a mouthful of blackening fangs. Wolf? Wolf turned and looked at him, smiling. His eyes flared a bright orange and looked for a moment both savage and intelligent. Then the glow faded, and they were only that muddy, perpetually puzzled hazel again. "Are you sort of a werewolf?"
"Sure am," Wolf said, smiling. "You pounded that nail, Jack. Wolf."
Jack sat down on a rock, looking at Wolf thoughtfully. He believed it would be impossible for him to be further surprised than he had already been, but Wolf managed the trick quite nicely.
"How's your father, Jack?"
he asked in that casual, by-the-way tone reserved for inquiring after the relatives of others.
"How's Phil doing these days?"
"Wolf?"
Jack made a queerly apt cross-association. He felt as if all the wind had been knocked out of his mind. For a moment it just sat there in his head, not a thought in it, like a radio station broadcasting nothing but a carrier wave. Then he saw Wolf's face change. The expression of happiness and childish curiosity was replaced by one of sorrow. Jack saw that Wolf's nostrils were flaring rapidly.
"He's dead, isn't he? Wolf? I'm sorry, Jack. God pound me, I'm stupid, stupid!"
Wolf crashed a hand into his forehead, and this time he really did howl. It was a sound that chilled Jack's blood. The herd of creep looked around uneasily.
"That's all right," Jack said.
He heard his voice more in his ears than in his head, as if someone else had spoken.
"But how did you know?"
"Your smell changed," Wolf said simply. "I knew he was dead because it was in your smell. Poor Phil, what a good guy. Tell you that right here and now, Jack. Your father was a good guy, Wolf."
"Yes," Jack said, "he was. But how did you know him? And how did you know he was my father?"
Wolf looked at Jack as though he had asked a question so simple it barely needed answering.
"I remember his smell, of course. Wolves remember all smells. You smell just like him."
Whack! The goofy stick came down on his head again. Jack felt an urge to just roll back and forth on the tough, springy turf, holding his gut and howling. People had told him he had his father's eyes and his father's mouth, even his father's knack for quick sketching. But never before had he been told that he smelled like his father. Yet he supposed the idea had a certain crazy logic at that.
"How did you know him?" Jack asked again.
Wolf looked at a loss.
"He came with the other one," he said at last. "The one from Oris. I was just little. The other one was bad. The other one stole some of us. Your father didn't know," he added hastily, as if Jack had shown anger. "Wolf? No, he was good, your father. Phil, the other one..."
Wolf shook his head slowly. On his face was an expression even more simple than his pleasure. It was the memory of some childhood nightmare.
"Bad," Wolf said. "He made himself a place in this world, my father says. Mostly he was in his twinner, but he was from your world. We knew he was bad, we could tell. But who listens to wolves? No one. Your father knew he was bad, but he couldn't smell him as good as we could. He knew he was bad, but not how bad."
And Wolf threw his head back and howled again, a long, chilly ululation of sorrow that resounded against the deep blue sky. Interlude. Sloat in This World, 2. From the pocket of his bulky parka, he had bought it convinced that from the Rockies east, America was a frigid wasteland after October 1st or so. Now he was sweating rivers. Morgan Sloat took a small steel box. Below the latch were 10 small buttons and an oblong of cloudy yellow glass, 1/4 inch high and 2 inches long. He pushed several of the buttons carefully with the fingernail of his left-hand pinky, and a series of numbers appeared briefly in the readout window.
Sloat had bought this gadget, billed as the world's smallest safe, in Zurich. According to the man who had sold it to him, not even a week in a crematory oven would breach its carbon steel integrity. Now it clicked open. Sloat folded back two tiny wings of ebony jeweler's velvet, revealing something he had had for well over 20 years, since long before the odious little brat who was causing all this trouble had been born. It was a tarnished tin key, and once it had gone into the back of a mechanical toy soldier. Sloat had seen the toy soldier in the window of a junk shop in the odd little town of Point Venuti, California, a town in which he had great interest. Acting under a compulsion much too strong to deny, he hadn't even wanted to deny it, not really, he had always made a virtue of compulsion, had Morgan Sloat, he had gone in and paid $5 for the dusty, dented soldier. And it wasn't the soldier he had wanted anyway. It was the key that had caught his eye and then whispered to him. He had removed the key from the soldier's back and pocketed it as soon as he was outside the junk shop door. The soldier itself he threw in a litter basket outside the Dangerous Planet bookstore. Now, as Sloat stood beside his car in the Lewisburg rest area, he held the key up and looked at it. Like Jack's croaker, the tin key became something else in the territories. Once, when coming back, he had dropped that key in the lobby of the old office building. And there must have been some territories magic left in it, because that idiot Jerry Bledsoe had gotten himself fried not an hour later. Had Jerry picked it up? Stepped on it, perhaps? Sloat didn't know and didn't care. Nor had he cared a tinker's damn about Jerry. And considering the handyman had had an insurance policy specifying double indemnity for accidental death, the building super with whom Sloat sometimes shared a hash pipe had passed this little tidbit on to him, Sloat imagined that Nita Bledsoe had done nip-ups. But he had been nearly frantic about the loss of his key. It was Phil Sawyer who had found it, giving it back to him with no comment other than, "Here, Morg, your lucky charm, isn't it? Must have a hole in your pocket. I found it in the lobby after they took poor old Jerry away." Yes, in the lobby. In the lobby where everything smelled like the motor of a wearing blender that had been running continuously on high speed for about 9 hours. In the lobby where everything had been blackened and twisted and fused. Except for this humble tin key. Which, in the other world, was a queer kind of lightning rod, and which Sloat now hung around his neck on a fine silver chain. "Coming for you, Jackie," said Sloat, in a voice that was almost tender. "Time to bring this entire ridiculous business to a crashing halt." Chapter 17 Wolf and the Herd. Wolf talked of many things, getting up occasionally to shoo his cattle out of the road, and once to move them to a stream about half a mile to the west. When Jack asked him where he lived, Wolf only waved his arm vaguely northward. He lived, he said, with his family. When Jack asked for clarification a few minutes later, Wolf looked surprised and said he had no mate and no children, that he would not come into what he called the Big Rut Moon for another year or two. That he looked forward to the Big Rut Moon was quite obvious from the innocently lewd grin that overspread his face. "But you said you lived with your family."
"Oh, family, them, Wolf." Wolf laughed. "Sure, them. We all live together, have to keep the cattle, you know, her cattle."
"The Queen's?"
"Yes. May she never, never die."
And Wolf made an absurdly touching salute, bending briefly forward with his right hand touching his forehead. Further questioning straightened the matter out somewhat in Jack's mind. At least he thought it did. Wolf was a bachelor, although that word barely fit somehow. The family of which he spoke was a hugely extended one, literally the Wolf family. They were a nomadic but fiercely loyal race that moved back and forth in the great empty areas east of the outposts, but west of the settlements, by which Wolf seemed to mean the towns and villages of the east. Wolves, never wolves, when Jack once used the proper plural, Wolf had laughed until tears spurted from the corners of his eyes, were solid, dependable workers for the most part. Their strength was legendary, their courage unquestioned. Some of them had gone east into the settlements where they served the queen as guards, soldiers, even as personal bodyguards. Their lives, Wolf explained to Jack, had only two great touchstones, the lady and the family. Most of the wolves, he said, served the lady as he did, watching the herds. The cow-sheep were the territory's primary source of meat, cloth, tallow, and lamp oil. Wolf did not tell Jack this, but Jack inferred it from what he said. All the cattle belonged to the queen, and the wolf family had been watching over them since time out of mind. It was their job. In this, Jack found an oddly persuasive correlative to the relationship that had existed between the buffalo and the Indians of the American plains, at least until the white man had come into those territories and upset the balance. "Behold, and the lion shall lie down with the lamb, and the wolf with the creep," Jack murmured and smiled. He was lying on his back with his hands laced behind his head. The most marvelous feeling of peace and ease had stolen over him. "What, Jack?" "Nothing," he said. "Wolf, do you really change into an animal when the moon gets full?"
"Course I do," Wolf said.
He looked astounded, as if Jack had asked him something like, "Wolf, do you really pull up your pants after you finish taking a crap?"
"Strangers don't, do they? Phil told me that."
"The, herd," Jack said. "When you change, do they..."
"Oh, we don't go near the herd when we change," Wolf said seriously. "Good Jason, no, we'd eat them. Don't you know that? And a wolf who eats of his herd must be put to death. The Book of Good Farming says so. Wolf, wolf, we have places to go when the moon is full. So does the herd. They're stupid, but they know they have to go away at the time of the big moon. Wolf, they better know, God pound them."
"But you do eat meat, don't you?" Jack asked.
"Full of questions, just like your father," Wolf said. "Wolf? I don't mind. Yeah, we eat meat, of course we do. We're wolves, aren't we?"
"But if you don't eat from the herds, what do you eat?"
"We eat well," Wolf said, and would say no more on that subject.
Like everything else in the territories, Wolf was a mystery that was both gorgeous and frightening. The fact that he had known both Jack's father and Morgan Sloat, had at least met their twinners on more than one occasion, contributed to Wolf's particular aura of mystery, but did not define it completely. Everything Wolf told him led Jack to a dozen more questions, most of which Wolf couldn't or wouldn't answer. The matter of Philip Sawtell's and Oris's visits was a case in point. They had first appeared when Wolf was in the Little Moon and living with his mother and two litter sisters. They were apparently just passing through, as Jack himself was now doing, only they had been heading east instead of west.
"Tell you the truth, you're just about the only human I've ever seen this far west who is still going west," Wolf said.
They had been jolly enough company, both of them. It was only later that there had been trouble with Oris. That had been after the partner of Jack's father had made himself a place in this world, Wolf told Jack again and again, only now he seemed to mean Sloat in the physical guise of Oris. Wolf said that Morgan had stolen one of his litter sisters.
"My mother bit her hands and toes for a month after she knew for certain that he took her," Wolf told Jack matter-of-factly,
"and had taken other wolves from time to time." Wolf dropped his voice and, with an expression of fear and superstitious awe on his face, told Jack that the limping man had taken some of these wolves into the other world, the place of the strangers, and had taught them to eat of the herd.
"That's very bad for guys like you, isn't it?" Jack asked.
"They're damned," Wolf replied simply.
Jack had thought at first that Wolf was speaking of kidnapping. The verb Wolf had used in connection with his litter sister, after all, was the territory's version of take. He began to see now that kidnapping wasn't what was going on at all, unless Wolf, with unconscious poetry, had been trying to say that Morgan had kidnapped the minds of some of the Wolf family. Jack now thought that Wolf was really talking about werewolves who had thrown over their ancient allegiance to the crown and the herd and had given it to Morgan instead. Morgan Sloat and Morgan of Oris. Which led, naturally enough, to thoughts of Elroy. A wolf who eats of his herd must be put to death. to thoughts of the men in the green car who had stopped to ask him directions and offered him a Tootsie Roll, and who had then tried to pull him into their car. The eyes had changed. They're damned. He made himself a place in this world. Until now, he had felt both safe and delighted. Delighted to be back in the territories where there was a nip in the air, but nothing like the dull, cold, gray bite of western Ohio. Safe with big, friendly Wolf beside him, way out in the country, miles from anything or anyone. Made himself a place in this world. He asked Wolf about his father, Philip Sawtell, in this world, but Wolf only shook his head. He had been a God-pounding good guy, and a twinner, thus obviously a stranger, but that was all Wolf seemed to know. Twinners, he said, was something that had something to do with litters of people, and about such business he could not presume to say. Nor could he describe Philip Sawtell. He didn't remember. He only remembered the smell. All he knew, he told Jack, was that while both of the strangers had seemed nice, only Phil Sawyer had really been nice. Once he had brought presents for Wolf and his litter sisters and litter brothers. One of the presents, unchanged from the world of the strangers, had been a set of bib overalls for Wolf. "I wore 'em all the time," Wolf said. "My mother wanted to throw 'em away after I'd worn 'em for 5 years or so. Said they were worn out. Said I was too big for 'em, Wolf. Said they were only patches, holding more patches together. I wouldn't give 'em up, though. Finally, she bought some cloth from a drummer headed out toward the outposts. I don't know how much she paid, and, Wolf, I'll tell you the truth, Jack, I'm afraid to ask. She dyed it blue and made me 6 pairs. The ones your father brought me, I sleep on them now. Wolf, Wolf, it's my God-pounding pillow, I guess." Wolf smiled so openly and yet so wistfully that Jack was moved to take his hand. It was something he never could have done in his old life, no matter what the circumstances. But that now seemed like his loss. He was glad to take Wolf's warm, strong hand. "I'm glad you liked my dad, Wolf," he said.
I did, Wolf, Wolf."
And then all hell broke loose. Wolf stopped talking and looked around, startled. "Wolf? What's..."
"Shh!"
Then Jack heard it. Wolf's more sensitive ears had picked the sound up first, but it swelled quickly. Before long, a deaf man would have heard it, Jack thought. The cattle looked around, and then began to move away from the source of the sound in a rough, uneasy clot. It was like a radio sound effect, where someone is supposed to be ripping a bedsheet down the middle very slowly. Only the volume kept going up and up and up until Jack thought he was going to go crazy. Wolf leaped to his feet, looking stunned and confused and frightened. That ripping sound, a low, ragged purr, continued to grow. The bleating of the cattle became louder. Some were backing into the stream, and as Jack looked that way, he saw one go down with a splash and a clumsy flailing of legs. It had been pushed over by its milling, retreating comrades. It let out a shrill, baaing cry. Another cow's sheep stumbled over it and was likewise trampled into the water by the slow retreat. The far side of the stream was low and wet, green with reeds, muddy, marshy. The cow-sheep who first reached this muck quickly became mired in it.
"Oh, you God-pounding, good-for-nothing cattle!" Wolf bellowed and charged down the hill toward the stream,
where the first animal to fall over now looked as if it were in its death throes.
"Wolf!"
Jack shouted, but Wolf couldn't hear him. Jack could barely hear himself over that ragged, ripping sound. He looked a little to the right on this side of the stream and gaped with amazement. Something was happening to the air. A patch of it, about 3 feet off the ground, was rippling and blistering, seeming to twist and pull at itself. Jack could see the western road through this patch of air, but the road seemed blurry and shimmery, as if seen through the heated, rippling air over an incinerator. "Something's pulling the air open like a wound. Something's coming through. From our side? Oh, Jason, is that what I do when I come through?" But even in his own panic and confusion, he knew it was not. Jack had a good idea who would come through like this, like a rape in progress. Jack began to run down the hill. The ripping sound went on and on and on. Wolf was down on his knees in the stream, trying to help the second downed animal to its feet. The first floated limply downstream, its body tattered and mangled.
"Get up! God pound you, get up, Wolf!"
Wolf shoved and slapped as best he could at the cow sheep, who milled and backed into him, then got both arms around the drowning animal's midriff and pulled upward.
"Wolf, here and now!" he screamed.
The sleeves of his shirt split wide open along the biceps, reminding Jack of David Banner having one of the gamma-ray-inspired tantrums that turned him into the Incredible Hulk. Water sprayed everywhere, and Wolf lurched to his feet, eyes blazing orange, blue overalls now soaked black. Water streamed from the nostrils of the animal, which Wolf held clutched against his chest as if it were an overgrown puppy. Its eyes were turned up to sticky whites.
"Wolf!" Jack screamed. "It's Morgan! It's the herd!"
Wolf screamed back.
"Wolf! Wolf! My God-pounding herd! Jack, don't try!"
The rest was drowned out by a grinding clap of thunder that shook the earth. For a moment, the thunder even covered that maddening, monotonous ripping sound. Almost as confused as Wolf's cattle, Jack looked up and saw a clear blue sky, innocent of cloud save for a few puffy white ones that were miles away. The thunder ignited outright panic in Wolf's herd. They tried to bolt, but in their exquisite stupidity, many of them tried to do it by backing up. They crashed and splashed and were rolled underwater. Jack heard the bitter snap of a breaking bone, followed by the baaing scream of an animal in pain. Wolf bellowed in rage, dropped the cow sheep he had been trying to save, and floundered toward the muddy far bank of the stream. Before he could get there, half a dozen cattle struck him and bore him down. Water splashed and flew in thin, bright sprays. Now Jack saw Wolf was the one in danger of being simultaneously trampled and drowned by the stupid fleeing animals. Jack pushed into the stream, which was now dark with roiling mud. The current tried continually to push him off balance. A bleeding cow sheep, its eyes rolling madly, splashed past him, almost knocking him down. Water sprayed into his face, and Jack tried to wipe it out of his eyes. Now that sound seemed to fill the whole world. Rip! Wolf! Never mind Morgan, at least not for the moment. Wolf was in trouble. His shaggy, drenched head was momentarily visible above the water, and then three of the animals ran right over him, and Jack could only see one waving, fur-covered hand. He pushed forward again, trying to weave through the cattle, some still up, others floundering and drowning underfoot.
"Jack!" A voice bellowed over that ripping noise. It was a voice Jack knew, Uncle Morgan's voice. "Jack!"
There was another clap of thunder, this one a huge oaken thud that rolled through the sky like an artillery shell. Panting, his soaked hair hanging in his eyes, Jack looked over his shoulder and directly into the rest area on I-70 near Lewisburg, Ohio. He was seeing it as if through ripply, badly made glass, but he was seeing it. The edge of the brick toilet was on the left side of that blistered, tortured patch of air. The snout of what looked like a Chevrolet pickup truck was on the right, floating 3 feet above the field where he and Wolf had been sitting peacefully and talking not 5 minutes ago. And in the center, looking like an extra in a film about Admiral Byrd's assault on the South Pole, was Morgan Sloat, his thick red face twisted with murderous rage. Rage and something else. Triumph? Yes, Jack thought that was what it was. He stood at midstream in water that was crotch deep, cattle passing on either side of him, baaing and bleeding, staring at that window which had been torn in the very fabric of reality, his eyes wide, his mouth wider.
"He's found me. Oh, dear God, he's found me." "There you are, you little shithead," Morgan bellowed at him.
His voice carried, but it had a muffled, dead quality as it came from the reality of that world into the reality of this one. It was like listening to a man shout inside a telephone booth.
"Now we'll see, won't we? Won't we?"
Morgan started forward, his face swimming and rippling as if made of limp plastic, and Jack had time to see there was something clutched in his hand, something hung around his neck, something small and silvery. Jack stood, paralyzed, as Sloat bowled his way through the hole between the two universes. As he came, he did his own werewolf number, changing from Morgan Sloat, investor, land speculator, and sometime Hollywood agent, into Morgan of Orris, pretender to the throne of a dying queen. His flushed, hanging jowls thinned, the color faded out of them. His hair renewed itself, growing forward, first tinting the rondure of his skull, as if some invisible being were coloring Uncle Morgan's head, then covering it. The hair of Sloat's twinner was long, black, flapping, somehow dead-looking. It had been tied at the nape of his neck, Jack saw, but most of it had come loose. The parka wavered, disappeared for a moment, then came back as a cloak and hood. Morgan Sloat's suede boots became dark leather knee boots, their tops turned down, what might have been the hilt of a knife poking out of one. And the small silver thing in his hand had turned to a small rod tipped with crawling blue fire. "It's a lightning rod. Oh, Jesus, it's a jock!" The cry was low, gargling, full of water. Jack whirled clumsily around in the stream, barely avoiding another cow sheep, this one floating on its side, dead in the water. He saw Wolf's head going down again, both hands waving. Jack fought his way toward those hands, still dodging the cattle as best he could. One of them bunted his hip hard, and Jack went over, inhaling water. He got up again quick, coughing and choking, one hand feeling inside his jerkin for the bottle, afraid it might have washed away. It was still there.
"Boy, turn around and look at me, boy!"
"No time just now, Morgan. Sorry, but I've got to see if I can avoid getting drowned by Wolf's herd before I see if I can avoid getting fried by your doomstick there." I blew fire arched over Jack's shoulder, sizzling. It was like a deadly electric rainbow. It struck one of the cow sheep caught in the reedy muck on the other side of the stream, and the unfortunate beast simply exploded, as if it had swallowed dynamite. Blood flew in a needle spray of droplets. Gobbets of flesh began to rain down around Jack.
"Turn and look at me, boy!"
He could feel the force of that command, gripping his face with invisible hands, trying to turn it. Wolf struggled up again, his hair plastered against his face, his dazed eyes peering through a curtain of it like the eyes of an English sheepdog. He was coughing and staggering, seemingly no longer aware of where he was. "Wolf!" Jack screamed, but thunder exploded across the blue sky again, drowning him out. Wolf bent over and retched up a great muddy sheet of water. A moment later, another of the terrified cow sheep struck him and bore him under again. "That's it," Jack thought despairingly. "That's it. He's gone. Must be. Let him go. Get out of here." But he struggled on toward Wolf, pushing a dying, weakly convulsing cow sheep out of his way to get there.
"Jason!"
Morgan of Orris screamed, and Jack realized that Morgan was not cursing in the territory's argo. He was calling his, Jack's, name. Only here he was not Jack. Here he was Jason. But the queen's son died an infant. Died. He, the wet, sizzling zap of electricity again, seeming almost to part his hair. Again it struck the other bank, this time vaporizing one of Wolf's cattle. No, Jack saw, at least not utterly. The animal's legs were still there, mired in the mud like shake poles. As he watched, they began to sag tiredly outward in four different directions.
"Turn and look at me, God pound you!"
The water. Why doesn't he throw it at the water? Fry me, Wolf, all these animals at the same time. Then his fifth-grade science came back to him. Once electricity went to water, it could go anywhere, including back to the generator of the current. Wolf's dazed face, floating underwater, drove these thoughts from Jack's flying mind. Wolf was still alive, but partially pinned under a cow sheep, which, although apparently unhurt, had frozen in panic. Wolf's hands waved with pathetic, flagging energy. As Jack closed the last of the distance, one of those hands dropped and simply floated, limp as a water lily. Without slowing, Jack lowered his left shoulder and hit the cow sheep like Jack Armstrong in a boy's sports story. If it had been a full-sized cow instead of a territory's compact model, Jack would probably not have budged it, not with the stream's fairly stiff current working against him. But it was smaller than a cow, and Jack was pumped up. It bawled when Jack hit it, floundered backward, sat briefly on its haunches, and then lunged for the far bank. Jack grabbed Wolf's hands and pulled with all of his might. Wolf came up, as reluctantly as a waterlogged tree trunk, his eyes now glazed and half-closed, water streaming from his ears and nose and mouth. His lips were blue. Twin forks of lightning blazed to the right and left of where Jack stood holding Wolf, the two of them looking like a pair of drunks trying to waltz in a swimming pool. On the far bank, another cow sheep flew in all directions, its severed head still bawling. Hot rips of fire zigzagged through the marshy area, lighting the reeds on the tussocks and then finding the drier grass of the field where the land began to rise again.
"Wolf!" Jack screamed. "Wolf, for Christ's sake!"
"Ugh!"
Wolf moaned and vomited warm, muddy water over Jack's shoulder. Now Jack saw Morgan standing on the other bank, a tall, puritanical figure in his black cloak. His hood framed his pallid, vampire-like face with a kind of cheerless romance. Jack had time to think that the territories had worked their magic even here, on behalf of his dreadful uncle. Over here, Morgan was not an overweight, hypertensive, actuarial toad with piracy in his heart and murder in his mind. Over here, his face had narrowed and found a frigid, masculine beauty. He pointed the silver rod like a toy magic wand, and blue fire tore the air open.
"Now you and your dumb friend!" Morgan screamed.
His thin lips split in a triumphant grin, revealing sunken yellow teeth that spoiled Jack's blurred impression of beauty once and forever. Wolf screamed and jerked in Jack's aching arms. He was staring at Morgan, his eyes orange and bulging with hate and fear.
"You devil!" Wolf screamed. "You devil! My sister! My litter sister! Wolf! Wolf! You devil!"
Jack pulled the bottle out of his jerkin. There was a single swallow left anyway. He couldn't hold Wolf up with his one arm. He was losing him, and Wolf seemed unable to support himself. Didn't matter, couldn't take him back through into the other world anyway. Or could he?
"You devil!"
Wolf screamed, weeping, his wet face sliding down Jack's arm. The back of his bib overalls floated and belled in the water. Smell of burning grass and burning animals, thunder exploding. This time the river of fire in the air rushed by Jack so close that the hairs in his nostrils singed and curled.
"Oh, yes, both of you," Morgan howled. "I'll teach you to get in my way, you little bastard! I'll burn both of you! I'll pound you down!"
"Wolf, hold on!" Jack yelled. He gave up his effort to hold Wolf up. Instead, he snatched Wolf's hand in his own and held it as tightly as he could. "Hold on to me, do you hear? Wolf!" He tipped the bottle up, and the awful, cold taste of rotted grapes filled his mouth for the last time. The bottle was empty. As he swallowed, he heard it shatter as one of Morgan's bolts of lightning struck it. But the sound of the breaking glass was faint, the tingle of electricity, even Morgan's screams of rage. He felt as if he were falling over backward into a hole, a grave, maybe. Then Wolf's hand squeezed down on Jack so hard that Jack groaned. That feeling of vertigo, of having done a complete dipsy-doodle, began to fade. And then the sunlight faded, too, and became the sad, purplish-gray of an October twilight in the heartland of America. Cold rain struck Jack in the face, and he was faintly aware that the water he was standing in seemed much colder than it had only seconds ago. Somewhere not far away, he could hear the familiar snoring drone of the big rigs on the interstate, except that now they seemed to be coming from directly overhead. Impossible, he thought. But was it? The bounds of that word seemed to be stretching with plastic ease. For one dizzy moment, he had an image of Flying Territories trucks driven by Flying Territories men with big canvas wings strapped to their backs. Back, he thought. Back again. Same time, same turnpike. He sneezed. Same cold, too. But two things were not the same now. No rest area here. They were standing thigh-deep in the icy water of a stream beneath a turnpike overpass. Wolf was with him. That was the other change. And Wolf was screaming. Chapter 18. Wolf Goes to the Movies. Overhead, another truck pounded across the overpass, big diesel engine bellowing. The overpass shook. Wolf wailed and clutched at Jack, almost knocking them both into the water. "Quit it!" Jack shouted. "Let go of me, Wolf! It's just a truck! Let go!" He slapped at Wolf, not wanting to do it. Wolf's terror was pathetic. But pathetic or not, Wolf had the best part of a foot and maybe 150 pounds on Jack, and if he overbore him, they would both go into this freezing water, and it would be pneumonia for sure.
"Wolf, don't like it! Wolf, don't like it! Wolf, Wolf!"
But his hold slackened. A moment later, his arms dropped to his sides. When another truck snored by overhead, Wolf cringed, but managed to keep from grabbing Jack again. But he looked at Jack with a mute, trembling appeal that said, "Get me out of this, please, get me out of this. I'd rather be dead than in this world." "Nothing I'd like better, Wolf, but Morgan's over there. Even if he weren't, I don't have the magic juice anymore." He looked down at his left hand and saw he was holding the jagged neck of Speedy's bottle, like a man getting ready to do some serious barroom brawling. Just dumb luck Wolf hadn't gotten a bad cut when he grabbed Jack in his terror. Jack tossed it away, splash. Two trucks, this time, the noise was doubled. Wolf howled in terror and plastered his hands over his ears. Jack could see that most of the hair had disappeared from Wolf's hands in the flip. Most, but not all. And he saw the first two fingers of each of Wolf's hands were exactly the same length. "Come on, Wolf," Jack said when the racket of the trucks had faded a little. "Let's get out of here. We look like a couple of guys waiting to get baptized on a PTL club special." He took Wolf's hand and then winced at the panicky way Wolf's grip closed down. Wolf saw his expression and loosened up a little.
"Don't leave me, Jack," Wolf said. "Please, please don't leave me."
"No, Wolf, I won't," Jack said. He thought, "How do you get into these things, you asshole? Here you are standing on a return pike overpass somewhere in Ohio with your pet werewolf. How do you do it? Do you practice? And, oh, by the way, what's happening with the moon, Jacko? Do you remember?" He didn't, and with clouds blanketing the sky and a cold rain falling, there was no way to tell. What did that make the odds? 30-1 in his favor? 28-2? Whatever the odds were, they weren't good enough, not the way things were going. "No, I won't leave you," he repeated, and then led Wolf toward the far bank of the stream. In the shallows, the decayed remains of some child's dolly floated, belly up, her glassy blue eyes staring into the growing dark. The muscles of Jack's arm ached from the strain of pulling Wolf through into this world, and the joint in his shoulder throbbed like a rotted tooth. As they came out of the water onto the weedy, trashy bank, Jack began to sneeze again. This time, Jack's total progress in the territories had been half a mile west, the distance Wolf had moved his herd so they could drink in the stream where Wolf himself had later almost been drowned. Over here, he found himself 10 miles farther west, as best he could figure. They struggled up the bank, Wolf actually ended up pulling Jack most of the way, and in the last of the daylight, Jack could see an exit ramp splitting off to the right some 50 yards up the road. A reflectorized sign read, "Arcanum, last exit in Ohio, state line 15 miles. "We've got a hitch," Jack said.
"Hitch?" Wolf said doubtfully.
"Let's have a look at you." He thought Wolf would do, at least in the dark. He was still wearing the bib overalls, which now had an actual Oshkosh label on them. His homespun shirt had become a machine-produced blue chambray that looked like an Army-Navy surplus special. His formerly bare feet were clad in a huge pair of dripping penny loafers and white socks. Oddest of all, a pair of round steel-rimmed spectacles of the sort John Lennon used to wear sat in the middle of Wolf's big face. "Wolf, did you have trouble seeing over in the territories?"
"I didn't know I did," Wolf said. "I guess so, Wolf. I sure see better over here with these glass eyes. Wolf, right here and now."
He looked out at the roaring turnpike traffic, and for just a moment Jack saw what he must be seeing. Great steel beasts with huge yellow-white eyes snarling through the night at unimaginable speeds, rubber wheels blistering the road.
"I see better than I want to," Wolf finished forlornly.
2 days later, a pair of tired footsore boys limped past the municipal town limit sign on one side of Highway 32 and a 10-4 diner on the other side, and thus into the city of Muncie, Indiana. Jack was running a fever of 102 degrees and coughing pretty steadily. Wolf's face was swollen and discolored. He looked like a pug that has come out on the short end in a grudge match. The day before, he had tried to get them some late apples from a tree growing in the shade of an abandoned barn beside the road. He had actually been in the tree and dropping shriveled autumn apples into the front of his overalls when the wall wasps, which had built their nest somewhere in the eaves of the old barn, had found him. Wolf had come back down the tree as fast as he could, with a brown cloud around his head. He was howling. And still, with one eye completely closed and his nose beginning to resemble a large purple turnip, he had insisted that Jack have the best of the apples. None of them was very good, small and sour and wormy, and Jack didn't feel much like eating anyway, but after what Wolf had gone through to get them, he hadn't had the heart to refuse. A big old Camaro, jacked in the back so that the nose pointed at the road, blasted by them. "Hey, assholes!" someone yelled, and there was a burst of loud, beer-fueled laughter. Wolf howled and clutched at Jack. Jack had thought that Wolf would eventually get over his terror of cars, but now he was really beginning to wonder. "It's all right, Wolf," he said wearily, peeling Wolf's arms off for the 20th or 30th time that day. "They're gone."
"So loud," Wolf moaned. "Wolf, Wolf, Wolf, so loud, Jack, my ears, my ears."
"Glass-pack muffler," Jack said, thinking wearily, "you'd love the California freeways, Wolf. We'll check those out if we're still traveling together, okay? Then we'll try a few stock car races and motorcycle scrambles. You'll be nuts about them." "Some guys like the sound, you know? But he went into another coughing fit that doubled him over. For a moment the world swam away in gray shades. It came back very, very slowly.
"Like it?" Wolf muttered. "Jason, how could anyone like it, Jack? And the smells!"
Jack knew that for Wolf the smells were the worst. They hadn't been over here 4 hours before Wolf began to call it the country of bad smells. That first night, Wolf had retched half a dozen times, at first throwing up muddy water from a stream which existed in another universe onto the Ohio ground, then simply dry-heaving. It was the smells, he explained miserably. He didn't know how Jack could stand them, how anyone could stand them. Jack knew. Coming back from the territories, you were bowled over by odors you barely noticed when you were living with them. Diesel fuel, car exhausts, industrial wastes, garbage, bad water, ripe chemicals. Then you got used to them again. Got used to them or just went numb. Only that wasn't happening to Wolf. He hated the cars, he hated the smells, he hated this world. Jack didn't think he was ever going to get used to it. If he didn't get Wolf back into the territories fairly soon, Jack thought he might go crazy. "He'll probably drive me crazy while he's at it," Jack thought. "Not that I've got far to go anymore." A clattering farm truck loaded with chickens ground by them, followed by an impatient line of cars, some of them honking. Wolf almost jumped into Jack's arms. Weakened by the fever, Jack reeled into the brushy, trash-littered ditch and sat down so hard his teeth clicked together.
"I'm sorry, Jack," Wolf said miserably. "God pound me."
"Not your fault," Jack said. Fall out. Time to take five. Wolf sat down beside Jack, remaining silent, looking at Jack anxiously. He knew how hard he was making it for Jack. He knew that Jack was in a fever to move faster, partly to outdistance Morgan, but mostly for some other reason. He knew that Jack moaned about his mother in his sleep, and sometimes cried. But the only time he had cried when awake was after Wolf went a little crazy on the Arcanum Turnpike ramp. That was when he realized what Jack meant by hitching. When Wolf told Jack he didn't think he could hitch rides, at least not for a while and maybe not ever, Jack had sat down on the top strand of guardrail cable and had wept into his hands. And then he had stopped, which was good, but when he took his face out of his hands, he had looked at Wolf in a way that made Wolf feel sure that Jack would leave him in this horrible country of bad smells, and without Jack, Wolf would soon go quite mad. They had walked up to the Arcanum exit in the breakdown lane, Wolf cringing and pawing at Jack each time a car or truck passed in the deepening dusk. Jack had heard a mocking voice drift back on the slipstream. "Where's your car, faggots?" He shook it off like a dog shaking water out of his eyes and had simply kept going, taking Wolf's hand and pulling him after when Wolf showed signs of lagging or drifting toward the woods. The important thing was to get off the turnpike proper, where hitchhiking was forbidden, and onto the westbound Arcanum entrance ramp. Some states had legalized hitching from the ramps, or so a road bum with whom Jack had shared a barn one night had told him, and even in states where thumbing was technically a crime, the cops would usually wink if you were on a ramp. So, first, get to the ramp. Hope no state patrol happened along while you were getting there. What a state trooper might make of Wolf, Jack didn't want to think about. He would probably think he had caught an 80s incarnation of Charles Manson in Lennon glasses. They made the ramp and crossed over to the westbound lane. 10 minutes later, a battered old Chrysler had pulled up. The driver, a burly man with a bull neck and a cap which read Case Farm Equipment tipped back on his head, leaned over and opened the door. "Hop in, boys. Dirty night, ain't it?" "Thanks, mister, it sure is," Jack said cheerfully. His mind was in overdrive, trying to figure out how he could work Wolf into the story, and he barely noticed Wolf's expression. The man noticed it, however. His face hardened. "You smell anything bad, son?" Jack was snapped back to reality by the man's tone, which was as hard as his face. All cordiality had departed it, and he looked as if he might have just wandered into the Oatly Tap to eat a few beers and drink a few glasses. Jack whipped around and looked at Wolf. Wolf's nostrils were flaring like the nostrils of a bear which smells a blown skunk. His lips were not just pulled back from his teeth, they were wrinkled back from them, the flesh below his nose stacked in little ridges. "What is he, retarded?" the man in the Case Farm Equipment hat asked Jack in a low voice. No, he just... Wolf began to growl. That was it. "Oh, Christ," the man said, in the tones of one who simply cannot believe this is happening. He stepped on the gas and roared down the exit ramp, the passenger door flopping shut. His taillights dot-dashed briefly in the rainy dark at the foot of the ramp, sending reflections in smeary red arrows up the pavement toward where they stood. "Boy, that's great," Jack said, and turned to Wolf, who shrank back from his anger. "That's just great. If he'd had a CB radio, he'd be on Channel 19 right now, yelling for a cop, telling anyone and everyone that there are a couple of loonies trying to hitch a ride out of Arcanum. Jason, or Jesus, or whoever, I don't care. You want to see some fucking nails get pounded, Wolf? You do that a few more times and you'll feel them get pounded. Us, we'll get pounded." Exhausted, bewildered, frustrated, almost used up, Jack advanced on the cringing Wolf, who could have torn his head from his shoulders with one hard swinging blow if he had wanted to, and Wolf backed up before him. "Don't shout, Jack," he moaned. "The smells! To be in there, shut up in there with those smells!" "I didn't smell anything," Jack shouted. His voice broke, his sore throat hurt more than ever, but he couldn't seem to stop. It was shout or go mad. His wet hair had fallen in his eyes. He shook it away and then slapped Wolf on the shoulder. There was a smart crack, and his hand began to hurt at once. It was as if he had slapped a stone. Wolf howled abjectly, and this made Jack angrier. The fact that he was lying made him angrier still. He had been in the territories less than 6 hours this time, but that man's car had smelled like a wild animal's den. Harsh aromas of old coffee and fresh beer, there had been an open can of Stroh's between his legs, an air freshener hanging from the rearview mirror that smelled like dry, sweet powder on the cheek of a corpse, and there had been something else, something darker, something wetter.
"Not anything!"
he shouted, his voice breaking hoarsely. He slapped Wolf's other shoulder. Wolf howled again and turned around, hunching like a child who was being beaten by an angry father. Jack began to slap at his back, his smarting hands spatting up little sprays of water from Wolf's overalls. Each time Jack's hand descended, Wolf howled.
"So you better get used to it, slap, because the next car to come along might be a cop, slap, or it might be Mr. Morgan Bloat in his puke-green BMW, slap, and if all you can be is a big baby, we're going to be in one big fucking world of hurt, slap. Do you understand that?"
Wolf said nothing. He stood hunched in the rain, his back to Jack, quivering, crying. Jack felt a lump rise in his own throat, felt his eyes grow hot and stinging. All of this only increased his fury. Some terrible part of him wanted most of all to hurt himself, and he knew that hurting Wolf was a wonderful way to do it.
"Turn around!"
Wolf did. Tears ran from his muddy brown eyes behind the round spectacles. Snot ran from his nose.
"Do you understand me?"
"Yes," Wolf moaned. "Yes, I understand, but I couldn't ride with him, Jack."
"Why not?"
Jack looked at him angrily, fisted hands on his hips. Oh, his head was aching.
"Because he was dying," Wolf said in a low voice.
Jack stared at him, all his anger draining away.
"Jack, didn't you know?"
Wolf asked softly.
"Wolf, you couldn't smell it?"
"No,"
Jack said in a small, whistling, out-of-breath voice. Because he had smelled something, hadn't he? Something he had never smelled before. Something like a mixture of... It came to him, and suddenly his strength was gone. He sat down heavily on the guardrail cable and looked at Wolf. Shit and rotting grapes. That was what that smell had been like. That wasn't it 100%, but it was too hideously close. Shit and rotting grapes.
"It's the worst smell," Wolf said. "It's when people forget how to be healthy. We call it, Wolf, the black disease. I don't even think he knew he had it. And these strangers can't smell it, can they, Jack?"
"No,"
he whispered. If he were to be suddenly teleported back to New Hampshire to his mother's room in the Alhambra, would he smell that stink on her? Yes. He would smell it on his mother, drifting out of her pores, the smell of shit and rotting grapes, the black disease.
"We call it cancer," Jack whispered. "We call it cancer, and my mother has it."
"I just don't know if I can hitch," Wolf said. "I'll try again if you want, Jack, but the smells inside, they're bad enough in the outside air, Wolf, but inside..."
That was when Jack put his face in his hands and wept, partly out of desperation, mostly out of simple exhaustion. And yes, the expression Wolf believed he had seen on Jack's face really had been there. For an instant, the temptation to leave Wolf was more than a temptation. It was a maddening imperative. The odds against his ever making it to California and finding the talisman, whatever it might be, had been long before. Now they were so long they dwindled to a point on the horizon. Wolf would do more than slow him down. Wolf would sooner or later get both of them thrown in jail, probably sooner. And how could he ever explain Wolf to rational Richard Sloat? What Wolf saw on Jack's face in that moment was a look of cold speculation that unhinged his knees. He fell on them and held his clasped hands up to Jack like a suitor in a bad Victorian melodrama.
Don't go away and leave me, Jack, he wept. Don't leave, old wolf. Don't leave me here. You brought me here. Please, please don't leave me alone.
Beyond this, conscious words were lost. Wolf was perhaps trying to talk, but all he really seemed able to do was sob. Jack felt a great weariness fall over him. It fit well, like a jacket that one has worn often. Don't leave me here. You brought me here. There it was. Wolf was his responsibility, wasn't he? Yes. Oh, yes, indeed. He had taken Wolf by the hand and dragged him out of the territories and into Ohio, and he had the throbbing shoulder to prove it. He had had no choice, of course. Wolf had been drowning, and even if he hadn't drowned, Morgan would have crisped him with whatever that lightning rod thing had been. So he could have turned on Wolf again, could have said, "Which would you prefer, Wolf, old buddy, to be here and scared or there and dead?" He could, yes. And Wolf would have no answer, because Wolf wasn't too swift in the brains department. But Uncle Tommy had been fond of quoting a Chinese proverb that went, "The man whose life you save is your responsibility for the rest of your life." Never mind the ducking, never mind the fancy footwork. Wolf was his responsibility.
"Don't leave me, Jack," Wolf wept. "Wolf, Wolf, please don't leave good old Wolf. I'll help you. I'll stand guard at night. I can do lots. Only don't
quit bawling and get up," Jack said quietly. "I won't leave you. But we've got to get out of here in case that guy does send a cop back to check on us. Let's move it."
"Did you figure out what to do next, Jack?" Wolf asked timidly.
They had been sitting in the brushy ditch just over the Muncie town line for more than half an hour, and when Jack turned toward Wolf, Wolf was relieved to see he was smiling. It was a weary smile, and Wolf didn't like the dark, tired circles under Jack's eyes. He liked Jack's smell even less. It was a sick smell. But it was a smile. "I think I see what we should do next right over there," Jack said. "I was thinking about it just a few days ago when I got my new sneakers." He bowed his feet. He and Wolf regarded the sneakers in depressed silence. They were scuffed, battered, and dirty. The left sole was bidding a fond adieu to the left upper. Jack had owned them for, he wrinkled his forehead and thought, the fever made it hard to think, 3 days. Only 3 days since he had picked them out of the bargain bin of the Favis store. Now they looked old. Old. "Anyway," Jack sighed. Then he brightened. "See that building over there, Wolf?" The building, an explosion of uninteresting angles in gray brick, stood like an island in the middle of a giant parking lot. Wolf knew what the asphalt in that parking lot would smell like, dead, decomposing animals. That smell would almost suffocate him, and Jack would barely notice it. "For your information, the sign there said Town Line Sixplex," Jack said. "It sounds like a coffee pot, but actually it's a movie with six shows. There ought to be one we like. And in the afternoon, there won't be many people there. And that's good because you have this distressing habit of going Section 8, Wolf. Come on." He got unsteadily to his feet.
"What's a movie, Jack?" Wolf asked.
He had been a dreadful problem to Jack, he knew. Such a dreadful problem that he now hesitated to protest about anything, or even express unease. But a frightening intuition had come to him that going to a movie and hitching a ride might be the same thing. Jack called the roaring carts and carriages cars, and Chevys and Jartrans and station wagons. These latter, Wolf thought, must be like the coaches in the territories which carried passengers from one coach station to the next. Might the bellowing, stinking carriages also be called movies? It sounded very possible. "Well," Jack said, "it's easier to show you than to tell you. I think you'll like it. Come on." Jack stumbled, coming out of the ditch, and went briefly to his knees.
"Jack, are you okay?" Wolf asked anxiously.
Jack nodded. They started across the parking lot, which smelled just as bad as Wolf had known it would. Jack had come a good part of the 35 miles between Arcanum, Ohio, and Muncie, Indiana, on Wolf's broad back. Wolf was frightened of cars, terrified of trucks, nauseated by the smells of almost everything, apt to howl and run at sudden loud noises, but he was also almost tireless. As far as that goes, you can strike the almost, Jack thought now. So far as I know, he is tireless. Jack had moved them away from the Arcanum ramp as fast as he could, forcing his wet, aching legs into a rusty trot. His head had been throbbing like a slick, flexing fist inside his skull, waves of heat and cold rushing through him. Wolf moved easily to his left, his stride so long that he was keeping up with Jack easily by doing no more than a moderately fast walk. Jack knew that he had maybe gotten paranoid about the cops, but the man in the Case Farm equipment hat had looked really scared and pissed. They hadn't gone even a quarter of a mile when a deep burning stitch settled into his side, and he asked Wolf if he could give him a piggyback for a while. Huh? Wolf asked. You know, Jack said, and pantomimed. A big grin had overspread Wolf's face. Here at last was something he understood. Here was something he could do.
You want a horsey back?
He cried, delighted.
Yeah, I guess. Oh, yeah, Wolf, here and now. Used to give him to my little brothers. Jump up, Jack!
Wolf bent down, holding his curved hands ready, stirrups for Jack's thighs. Now, when I get too heavy, just put me down. Before he could finish, Wolf had swept him up and was running lightly down the road with him into the dark. Really running. The cold, rainy air flipped Jack's hair back from his hot brow.
Wolf, you'll wear yourself out, Jack shouted. Not me, Wolf, Wolf, running here and now.
For the first time since they had come over, Wolf sounded actually happy. He ran for the next 2 hours, until they were west of Arcanum and traveling along a dark, unmarked stretch of two-lane blacktop. Jack saw a deserted barn standing slumped in a shaggy, untended field, and they slept there that night. Wolf wanted nothing to do with downtown areas where the traffic was a roaring flood and the stinks rose up to heaven in a noxious cloud, and Jack didn't want anything to do with them either. Wolf stuck out too much. But he had forced one stop at a roadside store just across the Indiana line near Harrisville. While Wolf waited nervously out by the road, hunkering down, digging at the dirt, getting up, walking around in a stiff little circle, then hunkering again, Jack bought a newspaper and checked the weather page carefully. The next full moon was on October 31st, Halloween, that was fitting enough. Jack turned back to the front page so he could see what day it was today. Yesterday, that had been now. It had been October 26th. Jack pulled open one of the glass doors and stepped inside the lobby of the Town Line Sixplex. He looked around sharply at Wolf, but Wolf looked, for the moment at least, pretty much okay. Wolf was, in fact, cautiously optimistic, at least for the moment. He didn't like being inside a building, but at least it wasn't a car. There was a good smell in here, light and sort of tasty. Or would have been, except for a bitter, almost rancid undersmell. Wolf looked left and saw a glass box full of white stuff. That was the source of the good light smell.
Jack, he whispered.
Huh?
I want some of that white stuff, please, but none of the pee.
Pee? What are you talking about? Wolf searched for a more formal word and found it.
Urine.
He pointed at a thing with a light going off and on inside it. Buttery flavoring, it read.
That's some kind of urine, isn't it? It's gotta be the way it smells.
Jack smiled tiredly. A popcorn without the fake butter, right, he said. Now pipe down, okay?
Sure, Jack, Wolf said humbly, right here and now.
The ticket girl had been chewing a big wad of grape-flavored bubble gum. Now she stopped. She looked at Jack, then at Jack's big, hulking companion. The gum sat on her tongue inside her half-open mouth like a large purple tumor. She rolled her eyes at the guy behind the counter. Two, please, Jack said. He took out his roll of bills, dirty, tag-eared ones with an orphan five hiding in the middle. Which show? Her eyes moved back and forth, Jack to Wolf and Wolf to Jack. She looked like a woman watching a hot table tennis match. What's just starting? Jack asked her. Well, she glanced down at the paper scotch tape beside her, there's The Flying Dragon in Cinema 4. It's a kung fu movie with Chuck Norris. Back and forth went her eyes, back and forth, back and forth. Then in Cinema 6 there's a double feature, two Ralph Bakshi cartoons, Wizards and The Lord of the Rings. Jack felt relieved. Wolf was nothing but a big overgrown kid, and kids loved cartoons. This could work out after all. Wolf would maybe find at least one thing in the country of bad smells that would amuse him, and Jack could sleep for 3 hours. That one, he said, the cartoons.
That'll be $4, she said. Bargain matinee prices end at 2.
She pushed a button, and 2 tickets poked out of a slot with a mechanical ratcheting noise. Wolf flinched backward with a small cry. The girl looked at him, eyebrows raised.
You jumpy, mister?
No, I'm Wolf, Wolf said. He smiled, showing a great many teeth. Jack would have sworn that Wolf showed more teeth now when he smiled than he had a day or two ago. The girl looked at all those teeth. She wet her lips.
He's okay. He just...
Jack shrugged. He doesn't get off the farm much, you know? He gave her the Orphan 5. She handled it as if she wished she had a pair of tongs to do it with. Come on, Wolf. As they turned away to the candy stand, Jack stuffing the 1 into the pocket of his grimy jeans, the ticket girl mouthed to the counterman, "Look at his nose." Jack looked at Wolf and saw Wolf's nose flaring rhythmically.
"Stop that," he muttered.
"Stop what, Jack?"
"Doing that thing with your nose."
"Oh, I'll try, Jack, but shh."
"Help you, son?"
the counterman asked.
"Yes, please. A junior mints, a Reese's Pieces, and an extra-large popcorn without the grease."
The counterman got the stuff and pushed it across to them. Wolf got the tub of popcorn in both hands and immediately began to snaffle it up in great jaw-cracking chomps. The counterman looked at this silently.
"Doesn't get off the farm much," Jack repeated.
Part of him was already wondering if these two had seen enough of sufficient oddness to get them thinking that a call to the police might be in order. He thought, not for the first time, that there was a real irony in all this. In New York or L.A., probably no one would have given Wolf a second look, or if a second look, certainly not a third. Apparently the weirdness toleration level was a lot lower out in the middle of the country. But of course Wolf would have flipped out of his gourd long since if they had been in New York or L.A.
"I'll bet he don't," the counterman said. "That'll be $2.80.
Jack paid it with an inward wince, realizing he had just laid out a quarter of his cash for their afternoon at the movies. Wolf was grinning at the counterman through a mouthful of popcorn. Jack recognized it as Wolf's A-number-1 friendly smile, but he somehow doubted that the counterman was seeing it that way. There were all those teeth in that smile. Hundreds of them, it seemed. And Wolf was flaring his nostrils again. "Screw it, let him call the cops if that's what they want to do," he thought with a weariness that was more adult than child. "It can't slow us down much more than we're slowed down already. He can't ride in the new cars because he can't stand the smell of the catalytic converters, and he can't ride in old cars because they smell like exhaust and sweat and oil and beer, and he probably can't ride in any cars because he's so goddamn claustrophobic. Tell the truth, Jacko, even if it's only to yourself. You're going along telling yourself he's going to get over it pretty soon, but it's probably not going to happen. So what are we going to do? Walk across Indiana, I guess. Correction, Wolf is going to walk across Indiana. Me, I'm going to cross Indiana riding horseyback. But first I'm going to take Wolf into this damn movie theater and sleep either until both pictures are over or until the cops arrive. And that is the end of my tale, sir."
"Well, enjoy the show," the counterman said.
"You bet," Jack replied. He started away, and then realized Wolf wasn't with him. Wolf was staring at something over the counterman's head with vacant, almost superstitious wonder. Jack looked up and saw a mobile advertising the reissue of Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters floating around on drafts of convection.
"Come on, Wolf," he said.
Wolf knew it wasn't going to work as soon as they went through the door. The room was small, dim, and dank. The smells in here were terrible. A poet, smelling what Wolf was smelling at that moment, might have called it the stink of sour dreams. Wolf was no poet. He only knew that the smell of the popcorn urine predominated, and that he felt suddenly like throwing up. Then the lights began to dim even further, turning the room into a cave.
"Jack," he moaned, clutching at Jack's arm. "Jack, we ought to get out of here, okay?"
"You'll like it, Wolf," Jack muttered, aware of Wolf's distress, but not of its depth. Wolf was, after all, always distressed to some degree. In this world, the word distress defined him. "Try it."
"Okay," Wolf said,
and Jack heard the agreement, but not the thin waver that meant Wolf was holding on to the last thread of his control with both hands. They sat down with Wolf on the aisle, his knees accordioned up uncomfortably, the tub of popcorn which he no longer wanted clutched to his chest. In front of them, a match flared briefly yellow. Jack smelled the dry tang of pot, so familiar in the movies that it could be dismissed as soon as identified. Wolf smelled a forest fire.
"Jack!
Shh, picture's starting, and I'm dozing off." Jack would never know of Wolf's heroism in the next few minutes. Wolf did not really know of it himself. He only knew that he had to try to stick this nightmare out for Jack's sake. It must be all right, he thought.
"Look, Wolf, Jack's going right to sleep, right here and now. And you know Jack wouldn't take you to a hurt place, so just stick it out. Just wait, Wolf. It'll be all right."
But Wolf was a cyclic creature, and his cycle was approaching its monthly climax. His instincts had become exquisitely refined, almost undeniable. His rational mind told him that he would be all right in here, that Jack wouldn't have brought him otherwise. But that was like a man with an itchy nose telling himself not to sneeze in church because it was impolite. He sat there, smelling forest fire in a dark, stinking cave, twitching each time a shadow passed down the aisle, waiting numbly for something to fall on him from the shadows overhead. And then a magic window opened at the front of the cave, and he sat there in the acrid stink of his own terror sweat, eyes wide, face a mask of horror, as cars crashed and overturned, as buildings burned, as one man chased another.
"Previews," Jack mumbled. "Told you you'd like it."
There were voices. One said no smoking. One said don't litter. One said group rates available. One said bargain matinee prices every weekday until 4 p.m.
"Wolf, we got screwed," Jack mumbled.
He started to say something else, but it turned into a snore. A final voice said, "And now our feature presentation," and that was when Wolf lost control. Bakshi's The Lord of the Rings was in Dolby Sound, and the projectionist had orders to really crank it in the afternoons, because that's when the heads drifted in, and the heads really liked loud Dolby. There was a screeching, discordant crash of brass. The magic window opened again, and now Wolf could see the fire, shifting oranges and reds. He howled and leaped to his feet, pulling with him a Jack who was more asleep than awake.
"Jack!" he screamed. "Get out! Gotta get out! Wolf! See the fire! Wolf! Wolf!"
"Down in front!" someone shouted.
"Shut up, hoser!" someone else yelled.
The door at the back of Cinema 6 opened. "What's going on in here?"
"Wolf, shut up," Jack hissed. "For God's sake, oh!" Wolf howled.
A woman got a good look at Wolf as the white light from the lobby fell on him. She screamed and began dragging her little boy out by one arm, literally dragging him. The kid had fallen to his knees and was skidding up the popcorn-littered carpet of the center aisle. One of his sneakers had come off. The pothead, three rows down, had turned around and was looking at them with bleary interest. He held a smoldering joint in one hand. A spare was cocked behind his ear.
"Far out," he pronounced. "Fucking werewolves of London strike again, right?"
"Okay," Jack said. "Okay, we'll get out. No problem. Just don't do that anymore, okay? Okay?" He started leading Wolf out. The weariness had fallen over him again. The light of the lobby hit his eyes sharply, needling them. The woman who had dragged the little boy out of the theater was backed into a corner with her arms around the kid.
When she saw Jack lead the still howling wolf through the double doors of Cinema 6, she swept the kid up and made a break for it. The counterman, the ticket girl, the projectionist, and a tall man in a sport coat that looked as if it belonged on the back of a racetrack tout were clustered together in a tight little group. Jack supposed the guy in the checkered sport coat and white shoes was the manager. The doors of the other cinemas in the Hive had opened partway. Faces peered out of the darkness to see what all the hoorah was. To Jack, they all looked like badgers peering out of their holes.
"Get out," the man in the checkered sport coat said. "Get out. I've called the police already. They'll be here in 5 minutes."
"Bullshit you did," Jack thought, feeling a ray of hope. "You didn't have time, and if we blow right away, maybe, just maybe, you won't bother."
"We're going," he said. "Look, I'm sorry, it's just that my big brother's an epileptic, and he just had a seizure. We forgot his medicine."
At the word epileptic, the ticket girl and the counterman recoiled. It was as if Jack had said leper.
"Come on, Wolf."
He saw the manager's eyes drop, saw his lip curl with distaste. Jack followed the glance and saw the wide, dark stain on the front of Wolf's Oshkosh bibballs. He had wet himself. Wolf also saw. Much in Jack's world was foreign to him, but he apparently knew well enough what that look of contempt meant. He burst into loud, braying, heartbroken sobs.
"Jack, I'm sorry. Wolf is so sorry."
"Get him out of here," the manager said contemptuously, and turned away. Jack put an arm around Wolf and got him started toward the door.
"Come on, Wolf," he said.
He spoke quietly and with an honest tenderness. He had never felt quite so keenly for Wolf as he did now. "Come on, it was my fault, not yours. Let's go."
"Sorry," Wolf wept brokenly. "I'm no good, God pound me, just no good."
"You're plenty good," Jack said. "Come on." He pushed open the door, and they went out into the thin, late October warmth. The woman with the child was easily 20 yards away, but when she saw Jack and Wolf, she retreated backward toward her car, holding her kid in front of her like a cornered gangster with a hostage.
"Don't let him come near me," she screamed. "Don't let that monster come near my baby, do you hear? Don't let him come near me."
Jack thought he should say something to calm her down, but he couldn't think what it might be. He was too tired. He and Wolf started away, heading across the parking lot at an angle. Halfway back to the road, Jack staggered. The world went briefly gray. He was vaguely aware of Wolf sweeping him up in his arms and carrying him that way, like a baby. Vaguely aware that Wolf was crying.
"Jack, I'm so sorry. Please don't hate Wolf. I can be a good old wolf. You wait. You'll see."
"I don't hate you," Jack said. "I know you're a good old..." But before he could finish, she had fallen asleep. When he woke up, it was evening, and Muncie was behind them. Wolf had gotten off the main roads and onto a web of farm roads and dirt tracks. Totally unconfused by the lack of signs and the multitude of choices, he had continued west with all the unerring instinct of a migrating bird. They slept that night in an empty house north of Kamek, and Jack thought in the morning that his fever had gone down a little. It was mid-morning of October 28th, when Jack realized that the hair was back on Wolf's palms. Chapter 19. Jack in the Box. They camped that night in the ruins of a burned-out house with a wide field on one side and a copse of woods on another. There was a farmhouse on the far side of the field, but Jack thought that he and Wolf would be safe enough if they were quiet and stayed in most of the time. After the sun went down, Wolf went off into the woods. He was moving slowly, his face close to the ground. Before Jack lost sight of him, he thought that Wolf looked like a nearsighted man hunting for his dropped spectacles. Jack became quite nervous. Visions of Wolf caught in a steel-jawed trap had begun to come to him. Wolf caught and grimly not howling as he gnawed at his own leg. Before, Wolf returned, walking almost upright this time, and carrying plants in both hands, the roots dangling out of his fists.
"What have you got there, Wolf?" Jack asked. "Medicine," Wolf said morosely.
But it's not very good, Jack. Wolf, nothing's much good in your world.
Medicine? What do you mean?
But Wolf would say no more. He produced two wooden matches from the bib pocket of his overalls and started a smokeless fire and asked Jack if he could find a can. Jack found a beer can in the ditch. Wolf smelled it and wrinkled his nose.
More bad smells. Need water, Jack. Clean water. I'll go if you're too tired.
Wolf, I want to know what you're up to.
I'll go, Wolf said. There's a farm right across that field, Wolf. There'll be water there. You rest.
Jack had a vision of some farmer's wife looking out the kitchen window as she did the supper dishes and seeing Wolf skulking around in the dooryard with a beer can in one hairy paw and a bunch of roots and herbs in the other.
I'll go, he said.
The farm was not 500 feet away from where they had camped. The warm yellow lights were clearly visible across the field. Jack went, filled the beer can at a shed faucet without incident, and started back. Halfway across the field, he realized he could see his shadow and looked up at the sky. The moon, now almost full, rode the eastern horizon. Troubled, Jack went back to Wolf and gave him the can of water. Wolf sniffed, winced again, but said nothing. He put the can over the fire and began to sift crumbled bits of the things he had picked in through the pop-top hole. 5 minutes or so later, a terrible smell, a reek, not to put too fine a point on it, began to rise on the steam. Jack winced. He had no doubt at all that Wolf would want him to drink that stuff, and Jack also had no doubt it would kill him. Slowly and horribly, probably. He closed his eyes and began snoring loudly and theatrically. If Wolf thought he was sleeping, he wouldn't wake him up. No one woke up sick people, did they? And Jack was sick. His fever had come back at dark, raging through him, punishing him with chills, even while he oozed sweat from every pore. Looking through his lashes, he saw Wolf set the can aside to cool. Wolf sat back and looked skyward, his hairy hands locked around his knees, his face dreamy and somehow beautiful. He's looking at the moon, Jack thought, and felt a thread of fear.
We don't go near the herd when we change. Good Jason, no, we'd eat them.
Wolf, tell me something. Am I the herd now?
Jack shivered. 5 minutes later, Jack almost had gone to sleep by then. Wolf leaned over the can, sniffed, nodded, picked it up, and came over to where Jack was leaning against a fallen, fire-blackened beam with an extra shirt behind his neck to pad the angle. Jack closed his eyes tightly and resumed snoring.
"Come on, Jack," Wolf said jovially. "I know you're awake. You can't fool Wolf."
Jack opened his eyes and looked at Wolf with bleary resentment.
"How did you know?"
People have a sleep smell and a wake smell, Wolf said. Even strangers must know that, don't they?
I guess we don't, Jack said.
Anyway, you have to drink this. It's medicine. Drink it up, Jack, right here and now.
I don't want it, Jack said. The smell coming from the can was swampy and rancid.
Jack, Wolf said, you've got a sick smell, too.
Jack looked at him, saying nothing.
Yes, Wolf said, and it keeps getting worse. It's not really bad, not yet, but, Wolf, it's going to get bad if you don't take some medicine.
Wolf, I bet you're great at sniffing out herbs and things back in the territories, but this is the country of bad smells, remember? You've probably got ragweed in there and poison oak and bitter vetch,
and they're good things, Wolf said, just not very strong, God pound them.
Wolf looked wistful.
Not everything smells bad here, Jack. There are good smells, too, but the good smells are like the medicine plants. Weak. I think they were stronger once.
Wolf was looking dreamily up at the moon again, and Jack felt a recurrence of his earlier unease.
I'll bet this was a good place once, Wolf said. Clean and full of power.
Wolf? Jack asked in a low voice. Wolf, the hairs come back on your palms.
Wolf started and looked at Jack. For a moment, it might have been his feverish imagination, and even if not, it was only for a moment. Wolf looked at Jack with a flat, greedy hunger. Then he seemed to shake himself, as if out of a bad dream.
Yes, he said. But I don't want to talk about that, and I don't want you to talk about that. It doesn't matter, not yet, Wolf. Just drink your medicine, Jack. That's all you have to do.
Wolf was obviously not going to take no for an answer. If Jack didn't drink the medicine, then Wolf might feel duty-bound to simply pull open his jaws and pour it down his throat.
Remember, if this kills me, you'll be alone, Jack said grimly, taking the can. It was still warm.
A look of terrible distress spread over Wolf's face. He pushed the round glasses up on his nose.
Don't want to hurt you, Jack. Wolf never wants to hurt Jack.
The expression was so large and so full of misery that it would have been ludicrous had it not been so obviously genuine. Jack gave in and drank the contents of the can. There was no way he could stand against that expression of hurt dismay. The taste was as awful as he had imagined it would be, and for a moment, didn't the world waver? Didn't it waver, as if he were about to flip back into the territories?
Wolf, he yelled. Wolf, grab my hand.
Wolf did, looking both concerned and excited.
Jack, Jackie, what is it?
The taste of the medicine began to leave his mouth. At the same time, a warm glow, the sort of glow he got from a small sip of brandy on the few occasions his mother had allowed him to have one, began to spread in his stomach. And the world grew solid around him again. That brief wavering might also have been imagination, but Jack didn't think so. We almost went. For a moment there, it was very close. Maybe I can do it without the magic juice. Maybe I can.
Jack? What is it?
I feel better, he said, and managed a smile.
I feel better, that's all.
He discovered that he did, too.
You smell better, too, Wolf said cheerfully. Wolf, Wolf.
He continued to improve the next day, but he was weak. Wolf carried him horsey back, and they made slow progress west. Around dusk, they started looking for a place to lie up for the night. Jack spotted a woodshed in a dirty little gully. It was surrounded by trash and bald tires. Wolf agreed without saying much. He had been quiet and morose all day long. Jack fell asleep almost at once, and woke up around 11, needing to urinate. He looked beside him and saw that Wolf's place was empty. Jack thought he'd probably gone in search of more herbs in order to administer the equivalent of a booster shot. Jack wrinkled his nose, but if Wolf wanted him to drink more of the stuff, he would. It surely had made him feel one hell of a lot better. He went around to the side of the shed, a straight, slim boy wearing jockey shorts, unlaced sneakers, and an open shirt. He peed for what seemed like a very long time indeed, looking up at the sky as he did so. It was one of those misleading nights which sometimes come to the Midwest in October and early November, not so long before winter comes down with a cruel iron snap. It was almost tropically warm, and the mild breeze was like a caress. Overhead floated the moon, white and round and lovely. It cast a clear and yet eerily misleading glow over everything, seeming to simultaneously enhance and obscure. Jack stared at it, aware that he was almost hypnotized, not really caring.
We don't go near the herd when we change. Good Jason, no.
Am I the herd now, Wolf? There was a face on the moon. Jack saw with no surprise that it was Wolf's face, except it was not wide and open and a little surprised, a face of goodness and simplicity. This face was narrow, yes, and dark. It was dark with hair, but the hair didn't matter. It was dark with intent.
We don't go near them. We'd eat them, eat them. We'd eat them, Jack. When we'd change, we'd...
The face in the moon, a chiaroscuro carved in bone, was the face of a snarling beast, its head cocked in that final moment before the lunge, the mouth open and filled with teeth.
We'd eat, we'd kill, 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 kill.
A finger touched Jack's shoulder and ran slowly down to his waist. Jack had only been standing there with his penis in his hand, the foreskin pinched lightly between thumb and forefinger, looking at the moon, Now a fresh, hard jet of urine spurted out of him.
"I scared you," Wolf said from behind him. "I'm sorry, Jack. God pound me."
But for a moment, Jack didn't think Wolf was sorry. For a moment, it sounded as if Wolf were grinning. And Jack was suddenly sure he was going to be eaten up. "House of bricks," he thought incoherently. "I don't even have a house of straw that I can run to."
Now the fear came, dry terror in his veins, hotter than any fever. "Who's afraid of the big bad wolf, the big bad wolf, the big bad Jack?"
I am. Oh, God, I am afraid of the big bad wolf."
He turned around slowly. Wolf's face, which had been lightly scruffed with stubble when the two of them crossed to the shed and lay down, was now heavily bearded from a point so high on his cheekbones that the hair almost seemed to begin at his temples. His eyes glared a bright red-orange.
"Wolf, are you all right?"
Jack asked in a husky, breathy whisper, and was as loud as he could talk. "Yes," Wolf said. "I've been running with the moon. It's beautiful. I ran and ran and ran, but I'm all right, Jack."
Wolf smiled to show how all right he was and revealed a mouthful of giant, rending teeth. Jack recoiled in numb horror. It was like looking into the mouth of that alien thing in the movies. Wolf saw his expression, and dismay crossed his roughened, thickening features. But under the dismay, and not far under either, was something else. Something that capered and grinned and showed its teeth. Something that would chase prey until blood flew from the prey's nose in its terror, until it moaned and begged. Something that would laugh as it tore the screaming prey open. It would laugh even if he were the prey. Especially if he were the prey.
"Jack, I'm sorry," he said. "The time. It's coming. We'll have to do something. We'll have to...
He looked up, and that hypnotized expression spread over his face as he looked into the sky. He raised his head and howled. And Jack thought he heard, very faintly, the wolf in the moon howl back. Horror stole through him, quietly and completely. Jack slept no more that night. The next day, Wolf was better. A little better, anyway, but he was almost sick with tension. As he was trying to tell Jack what to do, as well as he could anyway, a jet plane passed high overhead. Wolf jumped to his feet, rushed out, and howled at it, shaking his fists at the sky. His hairy feet were bare again. They had swelled and split the cheap penny loafers wide open. He tried to tell Jack what to do, but he had little to go on except old tales and rumors. He knew what the change was in his own world, but he sensed it might be much worse, more powerful, and more dangerous in the land of the strangers. And he felt that now. He felt that power sweeping through him, and tonight when the moon rose, he felt sure it would sweep him away. Over and over again, he reiterated that he didn't want to hurt Jack, that he would rather kill himself than hurt Jack. Daleville was the closest small town. Jack got there shortly after the courthouse clock struck noon and went into the True Value hardware store. One hand was stuffed into his pants pocket, touching his depleted roll of bills.
"Help you, son?"
"Yes, sir," Jack said. "I want to buy a padlock."
"Well, step over here and let us have a look. We've got Yales and Mosslers and Loctites and you name it. What kind of padlock you want?"
"A big one," Jack said, looking at the clerk with his shadowed, somehow disquieting eyes. His face was gaunt, but still persuasive in its odd beauty.
"A big one," the clerk mused. "And what would you be wanting it for, might I ask?"
"My dog," Jack said steadily. "A story. Always they wanted a story." He had gotten this one ready on the way in from the shed where they had spent the last two nights. "I need it for my dog. I have to lock him up. He bites." The padlock he picked out cost $10, leaving Jack with about $10 to his name. It hurt him to spend that much, and he almost went for a cheaper item. And then he had a memory of how Wolf had looked the night before, howling at the moon with orange fire spilling from his eyes. He paid the $10. He stuck out his thumb at every passing car as he hurried back to the shed, but of course none of them stopped. Perhaps he looked too wild-eyed, too frantic. He certainly felt wild-eyed and frantic. The newspaper the hardware store clerk had let him look at promised sunset at 6 o'clock p.m. on the dot. Moonrise was not listed, but Jack guessed 7 at the latest. It was already 1 p.m., and he had no idea where he was going to put Wolf for the night.
"You have to lock me up, Jack," Wolf had said. "Have to lock me up good, because if I get out, I'll hurt anything I can run down and catch hold of. Even you, Jack. Even you. So you have to lock me up and keep me locked up no matter what I do or what I say. 3 days, Jack, until the moon starts to get thin again. 3 days. Even 4 if you're not completely sure."
Yes, but where? It had to be someplace away from people so no one would hear Wolf if... When, he amended reluctantly, he began to howl. And it had to be someplace a lot stronger than the shed they had been staying in. If Jack used his fine new $10 padlock on the door of that place, Wolf would bust right out through the back. Where? He didn't know. But he knew he had only 6 hours to find a place, maybe less. Jack began to hurry along even faster. They had passed several empty houses to come this far, had even spent the night in one, and Jack watched all the way back from Daleville for the signs of lack of occupancy, for blank, uncovered windows and for sale signs, for grass grown as high as the second porch step, and the sense of lifelessness common to empty houses. It was not that he hoped he could lock Wolf into some farmer's bedroom for the 3 days of his change. Wolf would be able to knock down the door of the shed. But one farmhouse had a root cellar. That would have worked. A stout oaken door set into a grassy mound like a door in a fairy tale, and behind it a room without walls or ceiling, an underground room, a cave no creature could dig its way out of in less than a month. The cellar would have held Wolf, and the earthen floors and walls would have kept him from injuring himself. But the empty farmhouse and the root cellar must have been at least 30 or 40 miles behind them. They would never make it back there in the time remaining before moonrise. And would Wolf still be willing to run 40 miles, especially for the purpose of putting himself in a foodless, solitary confinement so close to the time of his change? Suppose, in fact, that too much time had passed. Suppose that Wolf had come too close to the edge and would refuse any sort of imprisonment. What if that capering, greedy underside of his character had climbed up out of the pit and was beginning to look around this odd new world, wondering where the food was hiding? The big padlock threatening to rip the seams out of Jack's pocket would be useless. He could turn around, Jack realized. He could walk back to Daleville and keep on going. In a day or two, he'd be nearly to LaPel or Cicero, and maybe he would work an afternoon at a feed store or get in some hours as a farmhand, make a few dollars or scrounge a meal or two, and then push all the way to the Illinois border in the next few days. Illinois would be easy, Jack thought. He didn't know how he was going to do this, exactly, but he was pretty sure he could get to Springfield and the Thayer School only a day or two after he made it into Illinois. And, Jack puzzled as he hesitated a quarter mile down the road from the shed, how would he explain Wolf to Richard Sloat? His old buddy Richard in his round glasses and ties and laced cordovans. Richard Sloat was thoroughly rational, and though very intelligent, hard-headed. If you couldn't see it, it probably didn't exist. Richard had never been interested in fairy tales as a child. He had remained unexcited by Disney films about fairy godmothers who turned pumpkins into coaches, about wicked queens who owned speaking mirrors. Such conceits were too absurd to snare Richard's 6-year-old or 8-year-old or 10-year-old fancy, unlike, say, a photograph of an electron microscope. Richard's enthusiasm had embraced Rubik's Cube, which he could solve in less than 90 seconds, but Jack did not think it would go so far as to accept a 6'5", 16-year-old werewolf. For a moment, Jack twisted helplessly on the road. For a moment, he almost thought that he would be able to leave Wolf behind and get on with his journey toward Richard and then the talisman. "What if I'm the herd?" he asked himself silently. And what he thought of was Wolf scrambling down the bank after his poor, terrified animals, throwing himself into the water to rescue them. The shed was empty. As soon as Jack saw the door leaning open, he knew that Wolf had taken himself off somewhere. But he scrambled down the side of the gully and picked his way through the trash almost in disbelief. Wolf could not have gone farther than a dozen feet by himself, yet he had done so. "I'm back," Jack called. "Hey, Wolf, I got the lock." He knew he was talking to himself, and a glance into the shed confirmed this. His pack lay on a little wooden bench. A stack of pulpy magazines dated 1973 stood beside it. In one corner of the windowless wooden shed, odd lengths of deadwood had been carelessly heaped, as if someone had once half-heartedly made a stab at squirreling away firewood. Otherwise, the shed was bare. Jack turned around from the gaping door and looked helplessly up the banks of the gully. Old tires scattered here and there among the weeds, a bundle of faded and rotting political pamphlets still bearing the name Luger, one dented blue and white Connecticut license plate, beer bottles with labels so faded they were white. No Wolf. Jack raised his hands to cup his mouth. "Hey, Wolf, I'm back!" He expected no reply and got none. Wolf was gone. "Shit," Jack said, and put his hands on his hips. Conflicting emotions, exasperation and relief and anxiety surged through him. Wolf had left in order to save Jack's life. That had to be the meaning of his disappearance. As soon as Jack had set off for Daleville, his partner had skipped out. He had run away on those tireless legs and by now was miles away, waiting for the moon to come up. By now, Wolf could be anywhere. This realization was part of Jack's anxiety. Wolf could have taken himself into the woods, visible at the end of the long field bordered by the gully, and in the woods gorged himself on rabbits and field mice and whatever else might live there, moles and badgers and the whole cast of The Wind in the Willows, which would have been dandy. But Wolf just might sniff out the livestock, wherever it was, and put himself in real danger. He might also, Jack realized, sniff out the farmer and his family. Or, even worse, Wolf might have worked his way close to one of the towns north of them. Jack couldn't be sure, but he thought that a transformed wolf would probably be capable of slaughtering at least half a dozen people before somebody finally killed him. "Damn, damn, damn," Jack said, and began to climb up the far side of the gully. He had no real hopes of seeing Wolf. He would probably never see Wolf again, he realized. In some small-town paper a few days down the road, he'd find a horrified description of the carnage caused by an enormous wolf, which had apparently wandered into Main Street looking for food. And there would be more names like Thielke, Heidel, Hagen. At first he looked toward the road, hoping even now to see Wolf's giant form skulking away to the east. He wouldn't want to meet Jack returning from Daleville. The long road was as deserted as the shed. Of course. The sun, as good a clock as the one he wore on his wrist, had slipped well below its meridian. Jack turned despairingly toward the long field and the edge of the woods behind it. Nothing moved but the tips of the stubble, which bent before a chill, wandering breeze. "Hunt continues for Killer Wolf," a headline would read a few days down the road. Then, a large brown boulder at the edge of the woods did move, and Jack realized that the boulder was Wolf. He had hunkered down on his heels and was staring at Jack. "Oh, you inconvenient son of a bitch," Jack said, and in the midst of his relief, knew that a part of him had been secretly delighted by Wolf's departure. He stepped toward him. Wolf did not move, but his posture somehow intensified, became more electric and aware. Jack's next step required more courage than the first. 20 yards farther, he saw that Wolf had continued to change. His hair had become even thicker, more luxuriant, as if it had been washed and blow-dried. And now Wolf's beard really did seem to begin just beneath his eyes. His entire body, hunkered down as it was, seemed to have become wider and more powerful. His eyes, filled with liquid fire, blazed Halloween orange. Jack made himself go nearer. He nearly stopped when he thought that Wolf now had paws instead of hands, but a moment later realized that his hands and fingers were completely covered by a thatch of coarse dark hair. Wolf continued to gaze at him with his blazing eyes. Jack again halved the distance between them, then paused. For the first time since he had come upon Wolf tending his flock beside a territory stream, he could not read his expression. Maybe Wolf had become too alien for that already, or maybe all the hair simply concealed too much of his face. What he was sure of was that some strong emotion had gripped Wolf. A dozen feet away, he stopped for good and forced himself to look into the werewolf's eyes. "Soon now, Jackie," Wolf said, and his mouth dropped open in a fearsome parody of a smile. "I thought you ran away," Jack said.
"Sat here to see you coming, Wolf."
Jack did not know what to make of this declaration. Obscurely, it reminded him of Little Red Riding Hood. Wolf's teeth did look particularly crowded, sharp, and strong. "I got the lock," he said. He pulled it out of his pocket and held it up. "You have any ideas while I was gone, Wolf?" Wolf's whole face, eyes, teeth, everything, blazed out at Jack.
"You're the herd now, Jackie," Wolf said,
and lifted his head and released a long, unfurling howl. A less frightened Jack Sawyer might have said, "Can that stuff, will ya?" or "We'll have every dog in the county around here if you keep that up." But both of these statements died in his throat. He was too scared to utter a word. Wolf gave him his A-number-one smile again, his mouth looking like a television commercial for Ginsu knives, and rose effortlessly to his feet. The John Lennon glasses seemed to be receding back into the bristly top of his beard and the thick hair falling over his temples. He looked at least 7 feet tall to Jack, and as burly as the beer barrels in the back room of the Oatly Tap.
"You have good smells in this world, Jackie," Wolf said.
And Jack finally recognized his mood. Wolf was exultant. He was like a man who, against steep odds, had just won a particularly difficult contest. At the bottom of this triumphant emotion percolated that joyful and feral quality Jack had seen once before.
"Good smells, Wolf, Wolf."
Jack took a delicate step backward, wondering if he was upwind of Wolf. "You never said anything good about it before," he said, not quite coherently.
"Before is before and now is now," Wolf said. "Good things, many good things all around. Wolf will find them, you bet."
That made it worse, for now Jack could see, could nearly feel, a flat, confident greed, a wholly amoral hunger shining in the reddish eyes. "I'll eat anything I catch and kill," it said. "Catch and kill." "I hope none of those good things are people, Wolf," Jack said quietly. Wolf lifted his chin and uttered a bubbling series of noises, half howl, half laughter.
"Wolves need to eat," he said, and his voice too was joyous. "Oh, Jackie, how wolves do need to eat. Eat, Wolf."
"I'm going to have to put you in that shed," Jack said. "Remember, Wolf, I got the lock? We'll just have to hope it'll hold you. Let's start over there now, Wolf. You're scaring the shit out of me." This time the bubbling laughter ballooned out of Wolf's chest.
"Scared? Wolf knows, Jackie. You have the fear smell."
"I'm not surprised," Jack said. "Let's get over to that shed now, okay?"
"Oh, I'm not going in the shed," Wolf said, and a long, pointed tongue curled out from between his jaws. "No, not me, Jackie, not Wolf. Wolf can't go in the shed." The jaws widened and the crowded teeth shone. "Wolf remembered, Jackie. Wolf, right here and now, Wolf remembered."
Jack stepped backward.
More fear smell, even on your shoes. Shoes, Jackie, wolf!
Shoes that smelled of fear were evidently deeply comic. You have to go in the shed. That's what you should remember.
Wrong, wolf. You go in the shed, Jackie. Jackie goes in shed. I remembered, wolf.
The werewolf's eyes slid from blazing reddish-orange to a mellow, satisfied shade of purple.
From the Book of Good Farming, Jackie. The story of the wolf who would not injure his herd. Remember it, Jackie? The herd goes in the barn, remember? The lock goes on the door. When the wolf knows this change is coming on him, the herd goes in the barn, and the lock goes on the door. He would not injure his herd.
The jaws split and widened again, and a long dark tongue curled up at the tip in a perfect image of delight.
Not injure his herd, wolf, right here and now.
You want me to stay locked up in the shed for 3 days? Jack said.
I have to eat, Jackie, wolf said simply.
And the boy saw something dark, quick, and sinister slide toward him from wolf's changing eyes.
When the moon takes me with her, I have to eat. Good smells here, Jackie. Plenty of food for wolf. When the moon lets me go, Jackie comes out of the shed.
What happens if I don't want to be locked up for 3 days?
Then wolf will kill Jackie, and then wolf will be damned.
This is all in the Book of Good Farming, is it? Wolf nodded his head.
I remembered in time, Jackie, when I was waiting for you.
Jack was still trying to adjust himself to Wolf's idea. He would have to go 3 days without food. Wolf would be free to wander. He would be in prison and Wolf would have the world. Yet it was probably the only way he would survive Wolf's transformation. Given the choice of a 3-day fast or death, he'd choose an empty stomach. And then it suddenly seemed to Jack that this reversal was really no reversal at all. He would still be free, locked in the shed, and Wolf out in the world would still be imprisoned. His cage would just be larger than Jack's. Then God bless the Book of Good Farming, because I would never have thought of it myself. Wolf gleamed at him again, and then looked up at the sky with a blank, yearning expression.
Not long now, Jackie. You're the herd. I have to put you inside.
Okay, Jack said. I guess you do have to. And this, too, struck Wolf as uproariously funny. As he laughed his howling laugh, he threw an arm around Jack's waist and picked him up and carried him all the way across the field.
Wolf will take care of you, Jackie, he said when he had nearly howled himself inside out.
He set the boy gently on the ground at the top of the gully.
Wolf, Jack said.
Wolf widened his jaws and began rubbing his crotch. You can't kill any people, Wolf, Jack said. Remember that. If you remembered that story, then you can remember not to kill any people, because if you do, they'll hunt you down for sure. If you kill any people, if you kill even one person, then a lot of people will come to kill you. And they'd get you, Wolf, I promise you. They'd nail your hide to a board.
No people, Jackie. Animals smell better than people. No people, Wolf.
They walked down the slope into the gully. Jack removed the lock from his pocket and several times clipped it through the metal ring that would hold it, showing Wolf how to use the key. Then you slide the key under the door, okay? He asked. When you've changed back, I'll push it back to you. Jack glanced down at the bottom of the door. There was a 2-inch gap between it and the ground.
Sure, Jackie. You'll push it back to me.
Well, what do we do now? Jack said. Should I go in the shed right now?
Sit there, Wolf said,
pointing to a spot on the floor of the shed a foot from the door. Jack looked at him curiously, then stepped inside the shed and sat down. Wolf hunkered back down just outside the shed's open door, and without even looking at Jack, held out his hand toward the boy. Jack took Wolf's hand. It was like holding a hairy creature about the size of a rabbit. Wolf squeezed so hard that Jack nearly cried out. But even if he had, he didn't think that Wolf would have hurt him. Wolf was staring upward again, his face dreamy and peaceful and rapt. After a second or two, Jack was able to shift his hand into a more comfortable position inside Wolf's grasp. Are we going to stay like this a long time? He asked.
Wolf took nearly a minute to answer.
Until, he said, and squeezed Jack's hand again.
They sat like that on either side of the door frame for hours, wordlessly, and finally the light began to fade. Wolf had been almost imperceptibly trembling for the previous 20 minutes, and when the air grew darker, the tremor in his hand intensified. It was, Jack thought, the way a thoroughbred horse might tremble in its stall at the beginning of a race, waiting for the sound of a gun and the gate to be thrown open.
"She's beginning to take me with her," Wolf said softly. "Soon we'll be running, Jack. I wish you could, too."
He turned his head to look at Jack, and the boy saw that while Wolf meant what he had just said, there was a significant part of him that was silently saying, "I could run after you as well as beside you, little friend." "We have to close the door now, I guess," Jack said. He tried to pull his hand from Wolf's grasp, but could not free himself until Wolf almost disdainfully released him.
"Lock Jackie in, lock Wolf out."
Wolf's eyes flared for a moment, becoming red, molten Elroy eyes. "Remember, you're keeping the herd safe," Jack said. He stepped backward into the middle of the shed.
"The herd goes in the barn, and the lock goes on the door. He would not injure his herd."
Wolf's eyes ceased to drip fire, shaded toward orange. "Put the lock on the door."
"God pound it, that's what I'm doing now," Wolf said. "I'm putting the God-pounding lock on the God-pounding door, see?"
He banged the door shut, immediately sealing Jack up in the darkness.
"Hear that, Jackie? That's the God-pounding lock."
Jack heard the lock click against the metal loop, then heard its ratchets catch as Wolf slid it home. "Now the key," Jack said.
"God-pounding key right here and now," Wolf said,
and a key rattled into a slot, rattled out. A second later, the key bounced off the dusty ground beneath the door, high enough to skitter onto the shed's floorboards.
"Thanks," Jack breathed.
He bent down and brushed his fingers along the boards until he touched the key. For a moment, he clamped it so hard into his palm that he almost drove it through his skin. The bruise, shaped like the state of Florida, would endure nearly 5 days, when, in the excitement of being arrested, he would fail to notice that it had left him. Then Jack carefully slid the key into his pocket. Outside, Wolf was panting in hot, regular, agitated-sounding spurts.
"Are you angry with me, Wolf?"
he whispered through the door. A fist thumped the door hard.
Not angry, Wolf!"
"All right," Jack said. "No people, Wolf. Remember that, or they'll hunt you down and kill you."
"No people."
The word turned into a long, liquid howl. Wolf's body bumped against the door, and his long, black, furred feet slid into the opening beneath it. Jack knew that Wolf had flattened himself out against the shed door.
"Not angry, Jack," Wolf whispered, as if his howl had embarrassed him. "Wolf isn't angry. Wolf is wanting, Jackie. It's so soon now, so God-pounding soon."
"I know," Jack said, now suddenly feeling as if he had to cry. He wished he could have hugged Wolf. More painfully, he wished that they had stayed the extra days at the farmhouse, and that he were now standing outside a root cellar where Wolf was safely jailed. The odd, disturbing thought came to him again that Wolf was safely jailed. Wolf's feet slid back under the door, and Jack thought he had a glimpse of them becoming more concentrated, slimmer, narrower. Wolf grunted, panted, grunted again. He had moved well back from the door. He uttered a noise very like, "Ah!" "Wolf?" Jack said. An ear-splitting howl lifted up from above Jack. Wolf had moved to the top of the gully. "Be careful," Jack said, knowing that Wolf would not hear him, and fearing that he would not understand him even if he were close enough to hear. A series of howls followed soon after, the sound of a creature set free, or the despairing sound of one who wakes to find himself still confined. Jack could not tell which.
Mournful and feral and oddly beautiful, the cries of poor Wolf flew up into the moonlight air like scarves flung into the night. Jack did not know he was trembling until he wrapped his arms around himself and felt his arms vibrating against his chest, which seemed to vibrate too. The howls diminished, retreating. Wolf was running with the moon. For 3 days and 3 nights, Wolf was engaged in a nearly ceaseless search for food. He slept from each dawn until just past noon, in a hollow he had discovered beneath the fallen trunk of an oak. Certainly, Wolf did not feel himself imprisoned, despite Jack's forebodings. The woods on the other side of the field were extensive and full of a wolf's natural diet. Mice, rabbits, cats, dogs, squirrels, all these he found easily. He could have contained himself in the woods and eaten more than enough to carry him through to his next change. But Wolf was riding with the moon, and he could no more confine himself to the woods than he could have halted his transformation in the first place. He roamed, led by the moon, through barnyards and pastures, past isolated suburban houses, and down unfinished roads where bulldozers and giant asymmetrical rollers sat like sleeping dinosaurs on the banks. Half of his intelligence was in his sense of smell, and it is not exaggerating to suggest that Wolf's nose, always acute, had now attained a condition of genius. He could not only smell a coop full of chickens 5 miles away and distinguish their odors from those of the cows and pigs and horses on the same farm, that was elementary. He could smell when the chickens moved. He could smell that one of the sleeping pigs had an injured foot and one of the cows in the barn an ulcerated udder. And this world, for was it not this world's moon which led him, no longer stank of chemicals and death. An older, more primitive order of being met him on his travels. He inhaled whatever remained of the earth's original sweetness and power, whatever was left of qualities we might once have shared with the territories. Even when he approached some human dwelling, even while he snapped the backbone of the family mutt and tore the dog into gristly rags he swallowed whole, Wolf was aware of pure, cool streams moving far beneath the ground, of bright snow on a mountain somewhere a long way west. This seemed a perfect place for a transmogrified wolf, and if he had killed any human being, he would have been damned. He killed no people. He saw none, and perhaps that is why. During the 3 days of his change, Wolf did kill and devour representatives of most other forms of life to be found in eastern Indiana, including one skunk and an entire family of bobcats living in limestone caves on a hillside 2 valleys away. On his first night in the woods, he caught a low-flying bat in his jaws, bit off its head, and swallowed the rest while it was still jerking. Whole squadrons of domestic cats went down his throat, platoons of dogs. With a wild, concentrated glee, he one night slaughtered every pig in a pen the size of a city block. But twice Wolf found that he was mysteriously forbidden from killing his prey, and this too made him feel at home in the world through which he prowled. It was a question of place, not of any abstract moral concern, and on the surface the places were merely ordinary. One was a clearing in the woods into which he had chased a rabbit, the other the scruffy backyard of a farmhouse where a whimpering dog lay chained to a stake. The instant he set a paw down in these places, his hackles rose and an electric tingling traversed the entire distance of his spine. These were sacred places, and in a sacred place a wolf could not kill. That was all. Like all hallowed sites, they had been set apart a long time ago, so long ago that the word ancient could have been used to describe them. Ancient is probably as close as we can come to representing the vast well of time. Wolf sensed about him in the farmer's backyard and the little clearing a dense envelope of years packed together in a small, highly charged location. Wolf simply backed off the sacred ground and took himself elsewhere. Like the wingmen Jack had seen, Wolf lived in a mystery, and so was comfortable with all such things. And he did not forget his obligations to Jack Sawyer.
In the locked shed, Jack found himself thrown upon the properties of his own mind and character more starkly than at any other time in his life. The only furniture in the shed was the little wooden bench, the only distraction the nearly decade-old magazines, and these he could not actually read. Since there were no windows, except in very early morning when light came streaming under the door, he had trouble just working out the pictures on the pages. The words were streams of gray worms, indecipherable. He could not imagine how he would get through the next 3 days. Jack went toward the bench, struck it painfully with his knee, and sat down to think. One of the first things he realized was that shed time was different from time on the outside. Beyond the shed, seconds marched quickly past, melted into minutes which melted into hours. Whole days ticked along like metronomes, whole weeks. In shed time, the seconds obstinately refused to move. They stretched into grotesque monster seconds, plastic man seconds. Outside, an hour might go by, while 4 or 5 seconds swelled and bloated inside the shed. The second thing Jack realized was that thinking about the slowness of time made it worse. Once you started concentrating on the passing of seconds, they more or less refused to move at all. So he tried to pace off the dimensions of his cell just to take his mind off the eternity of seconds it took to make up 3 days. Putting one foot in front of the other and counting his steps, he worked out that the shed was approximately 7 feet by 9 feet. At least there would be enough room for him to stretch out at night. If he walked all the way around the inside of the shed, he'd walk about 32 feet. If he walked around the inside of the shed 165 times, he'd cover a mile. He might not be able to eat, but he sure could walk. Jack took off his watch and put it in his pocket, promising himself that he would look at it only when he absolutely had to. He was about 1/4 of the way through his first mile when he remembered that there was no water in the shed. No food and no water. He supposed that it took longer than 3 or 4 days to die of thirst. As long as Wolf came back for him, he'd be all right. Well, maybe not all right, but at least alive. And if Wolf didn't come back, he would have to break the door down. In that case, he thought, he'd better try it now, while he still had some strength. Jack went to the door and pushed it with both hands. He pushed it harder, and the hinges squeaked. Experimentally, Jack threw his shoulder at the edge of the door, opposite the hinges. He hurt his shoulder, but he didn't think he had done anything to the door. He banged his shoulder against the door more forcefully. The hinges squealed, but did not move a millimeter. Wolf could have torn the door off with one hand, but Jack did not think that he could move it if he turned his shoulders into hamburger by running into it. He would just have to wait for Wolf. By the middle of the night, Jack had walked 7 or 8 miles. He lost count of the number of times he had reached 165, but it was something like 7 or 8. He was parched, and his stomach was rumbling. The shed stank of urine, for Jack had been forced to pee against the far wall, where a crack in the boards meant that at least some of it went outside. His body was tired, but he did not think he could sleep. According to clock time, Jack had been in the shed barely 5 hours. In shed time, it was more like 24. He was afraid to lie down. His mind would not let him go. That was how it felt. He had tried making lists of all the books he'd read in the past year, of every teacher he'd had, of every player on the Los Angeles Dodgers, but disturbing, disorderly images kept breaking in. He kept seeing Morgan Sloat tearing a hole in the air. Wolf's face floated underwater and his hands drifted down like heavy weeds. Jerry Bledsoe twitched and rocked before the electrical panel, his glasses smeared over his nose. A man's eyes turned yellow and his hand became a claw hoof. Uncle Tommy's false teeth coruscated in the Sunset Strip gutter. Morgan Sloat came toward him, his bald scalp suddenly rippling with black hair. But then Uncle Morgan was coming toward his mother, not himself. "Songs by Fats Waller," he said, sending himself around another circuit in the dark. "Your feet's too big. Ain't misbehavin', jitterbug waltz. Keepin' out of mischief now."
The Elroy thing reached out toward his mother, whispering lewdly, and clamped a hand down over her hip. Countries in Central America, Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, Costa Rica. Even when he was so tired, he finally had to lie down and curl into a ball on the floor, using his knapsack as a pillow. Elroy and Morgan Sloat rampaged through his mind. Osmond flicked his bullwhip across Lily Cavanaugh's back, and his eyes danced. Wolf reared up, massive, absolutely inhuman, and caught a rifle bullet directly in the heart. The first light woke him, and he smelled blood. His whole body begged for water, then for food. Jack groaned. Three more nights of this would be impossible to survive. The low angle of the sunlight allowed him dimly to see the walls and roof of the shed. It all looked larger than he had felt it to be last night. He had to pee again, though he could scarcely believe that his body could afford to give up any moisture. Finally, he realized that the shed seemed larger because he was lying on the floor. Then he smelled blood again and looked sideways toward the door. The skinned hindquarters of a rabbit had been thrust through the gap. They lay sprawled on the rough boards, leaking blood, glistening. Smudges of dirt and a long, ragged scrape show that they had been forced into the shed. Wolf was trying to feed him. "Oh, jeez," Jack groaned. The rabbit's stripped legs were disconcertingly human. Jack's stomach folded into itself. But instead of vomiting, he laughed, startled by an absurd comparison. Wolf was like the family pet who each morning presents his owners with a dead bird, an eviscerated mouse. With two fingers, Jack delicately picked up the horrible offering and deposited it under the bench. He still felt like laughing, but his eyes were wet. Wolf had survived the first night of his transformation, and so had Jack. The next morning brought an absolutely anonymous, almost ovoid knuckle of meat around a startlingly white bone splintered at both ends. On the morning of the fourth day, Jack heard someone sliding down into the gully. A startled bird squawked, then noisily lifted itself off the roof of the shed. Heavy footsteps advanced toward the door. Jack raised himself onto his elbows and blinked into the darkness. A large body thudded against the door and stayed there. A pair of split and stained penny loafers was visible through the gap. "Wolf?" Jack asked softly. "That's you, isn't it?"
"Give me the key, Jack."
Jack slipped his hand into his pocket, brought out the key, and pushed it directly between the penny loafers. A large brown hand dropped into view and picked up the key. "Bring any water?" Jack asked. Despite what he had been able to extract from Wolf's gruesome presence, he had come close to serious dehydration. His lips were puffy and cracked, and his tongue felt swollen, baked. The key slid into the lock, and Jack heard it click open. Then the lock came away from the door.
"A little," Wolf said. "Close your eyes, Jackie. You have night eyes now."
Jack clasped his hands over his eyes as the door opened, but the light which boomed and thundered into the shed still managed to trickle through his fingers and stab his eyes. He hissed with the pain.
"Better soon," Wolf said, very close to him.
Wolf's arms circled and lifted him.
"Eyes closed," Wolf warned, and stepped backward out of the shed.
Even as Jack said, "Water," and felt the rusty lip of an old cup meet his own lips, he knew why Wolf had not lingered in the shed. The air outside seemed unbelievably fresh and sweet. It might have been imported directly from the territories. He sucked in a double tablespoon of water that tasted like the best meal on earth and wound down through him like a sparkling little river, reviving everything it touched. He felt as though he were being irrigated. Wolf removed the cup from his lips long before Jack considered he was through with it.
"If I give you more, you'll just sick it up," Wolf said. "Open your eyes, Jack, but only a little bit."
Jack followed directions. A million particles of light stormed into his eyes. He cried out. Wolf sat down, cradling Jack in his arms.
Sip, he said,
and put the cup once more to Jack's lips.
Eyes open, little more.
Now the sunlight hurt much less. Jack peered out through the screen of his eyelashes at a flaring dazzle, while another miraculous trickle of water slipped down his throat.
Ah, Jack said. What makes water so delicious?
The western wind, Wolf promptly replied.
Jack opened his eyes wider. The swarm and dazzle resolved into the weathered brown of the shed and the mixed green and lighter brown of the gully. His head rested against Wolf's shoulder, the bulge of Wolf's stomach pressed into his backbone.
Are you okay, Wolf? He asked. Did you get enough to eat?
Wolves always get enough to eat, Wolf said simply.
He patted the boy's thigh. Thanks for bringing me those pieces of meat.
I promised. You were the herd, remember?
Oh, yes, I remember, Jack said. Can I have some more of that water?
He slid off Wolf's huge lap and sat on the ground where he could face him. Wolf handed him the cup. The John Lennon glasses were back. Wolf's beard was now little more than a scurf covering his cheeks. His black hair, though still long and greasy, fell well short of his shoulders. Wolf's face was friendly and peaceful, almost tired-looking. Over the bib overalls, he wore a gray sweatshirt about two sizes too small, with Indiana University Athletic Department stenciled on the front. He looked more like an ordinary human being than at any other time since he and Jack had met. He did not look as if he could have made it through the simplest college course, but he could have been a great high school football player. Jack sipped again. Wolf's hand hovered above the rusty tin cup, ready to snatch it away if Jack gulped.
You're really okay?
Right here and now, Wolf said.
He rubbed his other hand over his belly, so distended that it stretched the fabric at the bottom of the sweatshirt as taut as a hand would a rubber glove.
Just tired. Little sleep, Jack. Right here and now.
Where'd you get the sweatshirt?
It was hanging on a line, Wolf said. Cold here, Jackie.
You didn't hurt any people, did you?
No people, Wolf. Drink that water, slow now.
His eyes disconcertingly shaded into happy Halloween orange for a second, and Jack saw that Wolf could never really be said to resemble an ordinary human being. Then Wolf opened his wide mouth and yawned.
Little sleep.
He hitched himself into a more comfortable position on the slope and put down his head. He was almost immediately asleep. Part 3. A Collision of Worlds. Chapter 20. Taken by the Law. By 2 o'clock that afternoon, they were 100 miles west, and Jack Sawyer felt as if he too had been running with the moon. It had gone that easily. In spite of his extreme hunger, Jack sipped slowly at the water in the rusty can and waited for Wolf to awaken. Finally, Wolf stirred, said, "Ready now, Jack," hitched the boy up onto his back, and trotted into Daleville. While Wolf sat outside on the curb and tried to look inconspicuous, Jack entered the Daleville Burger King. He made himself go first to the men's room and stripped to the waist. Even in the bathroom, the maddening smell of grilling meat caused the saliva to spill into his mouth. He washed his hands, arms, chest, face. Then he stuck his head under the tap and washed his hair with liquid soap. Crumpled paper towels fell one after the other to the floor. At last he was ready to go to the counter. The uniformed girl there stared at him while he gave his order. His wet hair, he thought. While she waited for the order to come through, the girl stepped back and leaned against the service hatch, still unabashedly looking at him. He was biting into the first Whopper as he turned away toward the glass doors. Juice ran down his chin. He was so hungry he could scarcely bother to chew. 3 enormous bites took most of the big sandwich. He had just worked his mouth far enough around the remainder to take a fourth, when he saw through the doors that Wolf had attracted a crowd of children. The meat congealed in his mouth, and his stomach slammed shut. Jack hurried outside, still trying to swallow his mouthful of ground chuck, limp bread, pickles, lettuce, tomatoes, and sauce. The kids stood in the street on three sides of Wolf, staring at him every bit as frankly as the waitress had stared at Jack. Wolf had hunched down on the curb as far as he was able, bowing his back and pulling in his neck like a turtle. His ears seemed flattened against his head, the wad of food stuck in Jack's throat like a golf ball, and when he swallowed convulsively, it dropped down another notch. Wolf glanced at him out of the side of his eye and visibly relaxed. A tall, blue-jeaned man in his 20s opened the door of a battered red pickup 5 or 6 feet away down the curb, leaned against the cab, and watched, smiling. "Have a burger, Wolf," Jack said as carelessly as he could. He handed Wolf the box, which Wolf sniffed. Then Wolf lifted his head and took a huge bite out of the box. He began methodically to chew. Children, astounded and fascinated, stepped nearer. A few of them were giggling. "What is he?" asked a little girl with blonde pigtails tied with fuzzy pink gift-wrapping yarn. "Is he a monster?" A crew-cut boy of 7 or 8 shoved himself in front of the girl and said, "He's the Hulk, isn't he? He's really the Hulk, hey? Hey? Huh? Right?" Wolf had managed to extract what was left of his Whopper from its cardboard container. He pushed the whole thing into his mouth with his palm. Shreds of lettuce fell between his upraised knees, mayonnaise and meat juices smeared over his chin, his cheek. Everything else became a brownish pulp, smacked to death between Wolf's enormous teeth. When he swallowed, he started to lick the inside of the box. Jack gently took the container out of his hands. "No, he's just my cousin. He's not a monster, and he's not the Hulk. Why don't you kids get away and leave us alone, huh? Go on, leave us alone." They continued to stare. Wolf was now licking his fingers. "If you keep on gawping at him like that, you might make him mad. I don't know what he'd do if he got mad." The boy with the crew cut had seen David Banner's transformation often enough to have an idea of what anger might do to this monstrous Burger King carnivore. He stepped back. Most of the others moved back with him. "Go on, please," Jack said. But the children had frozen again. Wolf rose up mountainously, his fists clenched. "God pound you, don't look at me," he bellowed. "Don't make me feel funny. Everybody makes me feel funny." The children scattered. Breathing hard, red-faced, Wolf stood and watched them disappear up Daleville's main street and around the corner. When they were gone, he wrapped his arms around his chest and looked dartingly at Jack. He was miserable with embarrassment. "Wolf shouldn't have yelled," he said. "They were just little ones." "Big fat scare'll do 'em a lot of good," a voice said, and Jack saw that the young man from the red pickup was still leaning against his cab, smiling at them. "Never saw anything like that before myself. Cousins, are you?" Jack nodded suspiciously. "Hey, I didn't mean to get personal or anything." He stepped forward, an easy, dark-haired young man in a sleeveless down vest and a plaid shirt. "I especially don't want to make anybody feel funny now, you know." He paused, lifted his hands, palm out. "Really? I was just thinking that you guys look like you've been on the road a while." Jack glanced at Wolf, who was still hugging himself in embarrassment, but also glowering through his round glasses at this figure. "I've been there myself," the man said. "Hey, dig it. The year I got out of good old DHS, Daleville High, you know, I hitched all the way to Northern California and all the way back. Anyhow, if you're sort of going west, I can give you a lift."
"Can't, Jackie," Wolf spoke in a thunderous stage whisper.
"How far west?" Jack asked. "We're trying to make it to Springfield. I have a friend in Springfield." "Hey, no problema, senor," he raised his hands again. "I'm going just this side of Cayuga, right next to the Illinois border. You let me scarf a burger, we gone. Straight shot. 1.5 hours, maybe less. You'll be about halfway to Springfield."
"Can't," Wolf rasped again.
"There's one problem, okay? I got some stuff on the front seat. One of you guys will have to ride behind. It's going to be windy back there." "You don't know how great that is," Jack said, speaking nothing more than the truth. "We'll see you when you come back out." Wolf began to dance in agitation.
"Honest, we'll be out here, mister, and thanks."
He turned to whisper to Wolf as soon as the man went through the doors. And so when the young man, Bill Buck Thompson, for that was his name, returned to his pickup carrying the containers for two more Whoppers, he found a sedate-looking Wolf kneeling in the open back, his arms resting on the side panel, mouth open, nose already lifting. Jack was in the passenger seat, crowded by a stack of bulky plastic bags, which had been taped, then stapled shut, and then sprayed extensively with room freshener to judge by the smell. Through the translucent sides of the bags were visible long, frond-like cuttings, medium green. Clusters of buds grew on these amputated fronds. "I reckoned you still looked a little hungry," he said, and tossed another Whopper to Wolf. Then he let himself in on the driver's side across the pile of plastic bags from Jack. "Thought he might catch it in his teeth. No reflection on your cousin. Here, take this one. He already pulverized his." And 100 miles west they went, Wolf delirious with joy to have the wind whipping past his head, half hypnotized by the speed and variety of the odors which his nose caught in flight. Eyes blazing and glowing, registering every nuance of the wind, Wolf twitched from side to side behind the cab, shoving his nose into the speeding air. Buck Thompson spoke of himself as a farmer. He talked non-stop during the 75 minutes he kept his foot near the floor, and never once asked Jack any questions. And when he swung off onto a narrow dirt road just outside the Cayuga town line and stopped the car beside a cornfield that seemed to run for miles, he dug in his shirt pocket and brought out a faintly irregular cigarette, rolled in an almost tissue-like white paper. "I've heard of Red Eye," he said, "but your cousin's ridiculous." He dropped the cigarette into Jack's hand. "Have him take some of this when he gets excited, will you? Doctor's orders." Jack absently stuffed the joint into his shirt pocket and climbed out of the cab. "Thanks, Buck," he called up to the driver. "Man, I thought I'd seen something when I saw him eat," Buck said. "How'd he get him to go places? Yell mush, mush at him?" Once Wolf realized that the ride was over, he bounded off the back of the truck. The red pickup rolled off, leaving a long plume of dust behind it. "Let's do that again," Wolf sang out. "Jackie, let's do that again." "Boy, I wish we could," Jack said. "Come on, let's walk for a while. Someone will probably come along." He was thinking that his luck had turned, that in no time at all he and Wolf would be over the border into Illinois, and he'd always been certain that things would go smoothly once he got to Springfield and Thayer School and Richard. But Jack's mind was still partially in shed time, where what is unreal bloats and distorts whatever is real, and when the bad things started to happen again, they happened so quickly that he was unable to control them. It was a long time before Jack saw Illinois, and during that time he found himself back in the shed. The bewilderingly rapid series of events which led to the Sunlight home began 10 minutes after the two boys had walked past the stark little road sign telling them that they were now in Cayuga, population 23,568. Cayuga itself was nowhere visible. To their right, the endless cornfield rolled across the land. To their left, a bare field allowed them to see how the road bent, then arrowed straight toward the flat horizon. Just after Jack had realized that they would probably have to walk all the way into town to get their next ride, a car appeared on this road, traveling fast toward them. "Riding back?" Wolf yelled, joyfully raising his arms up over his head. "Wolf riding back, right here and now!" "It's going the wrong way," Jack said. "Just be calm and let it pass us, Wolf. Get your arms down or he'll think you're signaling him." Reluctantly, Wolf lowered his arms. The car had come nearly to the bend in the road, which would take it directly past Jack and Wolf. "No ride in the back now?" Wolf asked, pouting almost childishly. Jack shook his head. He was staring at an oval medallion painted on the car's dusty white door panel. County Parks Commission, this might have said, or State Wildlife Board. It might have been anything from the vehicle of the state agricultural agent to the property of the Cayuga Maintenance Department. But when it turned into the bend, Jack saw it was a police car. That's a cop, Wolf. A policeman. Just keep walking and stay nice and loose. We don't want him to stop.
What's a coppisman?
Wolf's voice had dropped into a dark brown range. He had seen that the speeding car was now coming straight toward him.
Does a coppisman kill wolves?
No, Jack said. They absolutely never kill wolves. But it did no good. Wolf captured Jack's hand in his own, which trembled. Let go of me, please, Wolf, Jack pleaded. He'll think it's funny. Wolf's hand dropped away. As the police car advanced toward them, Jack glanced at the figure behind the wheel, and then turned around and walked back a few paces so that he could watch Wolf. What he had seen was not encouraging. The policeman driving the car had a wide, doughy, domineering face with livid slabs of fat where he'd once had cheekbones. And Wolf's terror was plain on his face. Eyes, nostrils flared. He was showing his teeth. You really liked riding in the back of that truck, didn't you? Jack asked him. Some of the terror disappeared, and Wolf nearly managed a smile. The police car roared past. Jack was conscious of the driver turning his head to inspect them. All right, Jack said. He's on his way. We're okay, Wolf. He had turned around again when he heard the sound of the police car suddenly begin to grow louder again.
Coppisman's coming back.
Probably just going back to Cayuga, Jack said. Turn around and just act like me. Don't stare at him. Wolf and Jack trudged along, pretending to ignore the car, which seemed to hang behind them deliberately. Wolf uttered a sound that was half moan, half howl. The police car swung out into the road, passed them, flashed its brake lights, and then cut in diagonally before them. The officer pushed open his door and got his feet planted on the ground. Then he hoisted himself out of the seat. He was roughly Jack's height, and all his weight was in his face and his stomach. His legs were twig skinny, his arms and shoulders those of a normally developed man. His gut, trussed in the brown uniform like a 15-pound turkey, bulged out on both sides of the wide brown belt.
I can't wait for it, he said, and cocked an arm and leaned on the open door. What's your story anyhow? Give.
Wolf padded up behind Jack and hunched his shoulders, his hands shoved deep into the pockets of his overalls.
We're going to Springfield, officer, Jack said. We've been hitching. I guess maybe we shouldn't.
You guess maybe you shouldn't. Holy shit, what's this guy trying to disappear behind you, a Wookiee?
He's my cousin. Jack thought frantically for a moment. The story had to be bent far enough to accommodate Wolf. I'm supposed to be taking him home. He lives in Springfield with his Aunt Helen. I mean, my Aunt Helen, the one who's a schoolteacher in Springfield.
What did he do, escape from somewhere?
No, nothing like that. It was just that...
The cop looked at him neutrally, his face sizzling.
Names?
Now the boy met a dilemma. Wolf was certain to call him Jack, no matter what name he gave the cop.
I'm Jack Parker, he said. And he's hold it. I want the Phoebe to tell me himself.
Come on, you. You remember your name, basket case?
Wolf squirmed behind Jack, digging his chin into the top of his overalls. He muttered something.
I couldn't hear you, sonny.
Wolf, he whispered.
Wolf? Probably I should have guessed. What's your first name, or did they just give you a number?
Wolf had squeezed his eyes shut and was twisting his legs together.
Come on, Phil, Jack said, thinking that it was one of the few names Wolf might remember. But he had just finished it when Wolf pulled up his head and straightened his back and yelled, Jack! Jack! Jack Wolf!
We call him Jack sometimes, the boy put in, knowing it was already too late. It's because he likes me so much. Sometimes I'm the only one who can do anything with him. I might even stay there in Springfield a few days after I get him home just to make sure he settles down okay.
I sure am sick of the sound of your voice, Jack boy. Why don't you and good old Phil Jack get in the back seat here and we'll go into town and straighten everything out?
When Jack did not move, the policeman put a hand on the butt of the enormous pistol which hung from his straining belt.
Get in the car. Him first. I want to find out why you're 100 miles from home on a school day. In the car, right now.
Officer, Jack began, and behind him Wolf rasped,
No, can't.
My cousin has this problem, Jack said. He's claustrophobic. Small spaces, especially the insides of cars, drive him crazy. We can only get rides in pickups, so he can be in the back.
Get in the car, the policeman said.
He stepped forward and opened the back door.
Can't, Wolf wailed. Wolf can't! Stinks, Jackie, it stinks in there.
His nose and lip had wrinkled into corrugations.
You get him in the car, or I will, the cop said to Jack.
Wolf, it won't be for long, Jack said, reaching for Wolf's hand. Reluctantly, Wolf allowed him to take it. Jack pulled him toward the back seat of the police car, Wolf literally dragging his feet across the surface of the road. For a couple of seconds, it looked as though it would work. Wolf got close enough to the police car to touch the door frame. Then his entire body shook. He clamped both hands onto the top of the door frame. It looked as though he were going to try to rip the top of the car in half, as a circus strongman tears a telephone book in two. Please, Jack said quietly, we have to. But Wolf was terrified and too disgusted by whatever he had smelled. He shook his head violently. Slobber ran from his mouth and dripped onto the top of the car. The policeman stepped around Jack and released something from a catch on his belt. Jack had time only to see that it was not his pistol before the cop expertly whapped his blackjack into the base of Wolf's skull. Wolf's upper body dropped onto the top of the car, and then all of Wolf slid gracefully down onto the dusty road.
You get on his other side, the cop said, fastening the sap to his belt. We're finally going to get this big bag of shit into the vehicle.
2 or 3 minutes later, after they had twice dropped Wolf's heavy, unconscious body back onto the road, they were speeding toward Cayuga.
I already know what's going to happen to you and your feeble cousin, if he is your cousin, which I doubt.
The cop looked up at Jack in his rearview mirror, and his eyes were raisins dipped in fresh tar. All the blood in Jack's body seemed to swing down, down in his veins, and his heart jumped in his chest. He had remembered the cigarette in his shirt pocket. He clapped his hand over it, then jerked his hand away before the cop could say anything.
I gotta put his shoes back on, Jack said. They sort of fell off.
Forget it, the cop said, but did not object further when Jack bent over. Out of sight of the mirror, he first shoved one of the split-seamed loafers back up on Wolf's bare heel, then quickly snatched the joint out of his pocket and popped it in his mouth. He bit into it, and dry, crumbly particles with an oddly herbal taste spilled over his tongue. Jack began to grind them between his teeth. Something scratched down into his throat, and he convulsively jerked upright, put his hand in front of his mouth, and tried to cough with his lips together. When his throat was clear, he hurriedly swallowed all of the dampened, now rather sludgy, marijuana. Jack ran his tongue over his teeth, collecting all the flecks and traces.
"You got a few surprises ahead of you," the policeman said. "You're going to get a little sunlight in your soul."
"Sunlight in my soul?" Jack asked, thinking that the cop had seen him stuff the joint into his mouth.
"A few blisters on your hands, too," the cop said, and glared happily at Jack's guilty image in the rearview mirror.
The Cayuga Municipal Building was a shadowy maze of unlighted hallways and narrow staircases that seemed to wind unexpectedly upward alongside equally narrow rooms.